Mike Myers is in the house.
That's right. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me know if there's too much background noise. I have the door open.
All right. Well, same to you. I have the window open nearby. So
starting to get to that time of year.
Yeah. People are starting to stir outside.
Lots of bird activity.
Yeah. Yep. Tweedly leet.
Tweedly leet. So how have you been?
Pretty good. It's been a busy weekend.
Oh, yeah?
Had a lot of stuff going on.
A lot of events?
A little bit. Had a wedding yesterday and took Luna to the vet for her checkup. And
how's she doing?
Pretty good for senior citizen.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, she's 14, so.
Yeah.
She's in pretty good shape. So, but, yeah, just been busy so far. But not a bad weekend. The weather's been nice.
Yeah, it has. It's been very nice the whole week over here.
That's good. Last time we talked to you, I had just gotten some snow, I think.
Yeah. I think we're done with it, I hope. There's still snow on the peak, but that elevation's really high.
Yeah. Now, did you plant your marijuana crops yet?
No, I haven't done that.
Your six plants or something like that you're allowed? That would be funny if you became a huge stoner out of nowhere. You're just stoned out of your mind for podcast.
That's right. I'm allowed six plants. Doesn't mean I can't smoke them all. There's weird stuff. Like, you still can't really do it because it's federal. There's still, like, some weird line. Like, state allows it, but federal doesn't. And
yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of...
I'd probably die anyway because of asthma. I don't want any shit in my lungs.
Oh, man, I can't either. Like, in college for about a year, I smoked cigarettes.
Yeah.
Because I was around it all the time, and I was getting so much secondhand smoke that I think I, you know, just ended up having an appeal to me. But, you know, it was pretty short-lived, and I got sick of it. But if I'm even around secondhand smoke now, just because a few years after that, I developed allergies for the first time, and they've gotten better than they were for a while there, but... If I tried to smoke anything, I feel like I can't breathe.
Yeah. I used to study with smokers. I mean, like, heavy smokers. So, like, in college.
Yeah.
So, it was like, it became, like, nature to me, but I still couldn't stand it. But now that they've kind of said you can't smoke in the restaurant, you can't smoke in the bars, you can't smoke. It's like you've come accustomed to the fresh air, and when somebody that does smoke... comes by, they smell like extra smelly. Like, I can't like take it.
Yeah.
And it's weird because I used to be around it so much, but because of all the laws now about, you know, smoking in areas, it's changed my sensitivity to it, I guess.
Yeah.
Now I'm more sensitive to it. Like yesterday I was watching Star Trek Into the Darkness and some guy came and sat next to me, and I was like, holy crap, he must have smoked in like a whole carton of cigarettes.
Yeah, if you're not around, it's amazing how sensitive your nose comes to it. Like, we had a guy from the cable company come and do something in the house, I think, last weekend. And the room that he was working in, I had to bring a candle in there and light it after he left because he just carried that scent with him, and that. And the smoke smell lingered for a couple hours after he left. I was like, damn.
Yeah.
It's pretty strong. But yeah, that was...
But it's weird, though, because, you know, I was around it so much, and I'm talking like 10 hours a day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean...
So it was like, it never fazed me.
The time period I'm talking about where I ended up smoking myself, I lived in a house with a bunch of other guys in college, and... three of them, you know, there was like five of us, I think, and three of them were regular smokers, you know, wake up and have, that was the first thing they did.
Yeah.
You know, so I was just around it so much. And then that was in Pennsylvania, and, they still hadn't passed any sort of, New York was really early in passing a Bill about smoking in bars and stuff, but when I was in college in Pennsylvania, they didn't have a law down there yet, and you know, so anytime we went out, you know, bars were just soaked in cigarette smoke. So
yeah, or if you went to a pool hall or anything kind of like that, it'd be a lot of smoking.
Yep.
And you got used to it. Even at restaurants, like, I wouldn't mind, like, they say smoking or non-smoking. I was like, I don't care. I just want a seat.
Yeah.
It didn't bother me at the time. But now society has made it, you know, separated it, and now I'm not used to it anymore. But you know what really I don't like is cigar smoke.
Yeah.
Because I got deathly ill because I went to a bachelor party for my friend, mm-hmm. like, right before I moved here. Mm-hmm. And they had like cigars in there, you know, to celebrate and stuff. And the room was like smelling like cigar. Mm-hmm. I smelled like cigar. It was like I was throwing up the next day, like because of the intake. You know, it was just it's bad.
Yeah. No, it'll take its toll on you. Definitely, that is for sure.
A cigar is just a cigar.
Yeah, it wasn't that kind of bachelor party, was it?
He's so funny, man. He's like, you know, associating certain things with like sexual activity, like Sigmund Freud, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then when he sticks a cigar in his mouth, but a cigar is just a cigar. I'm like, yeah, it's like it's not a huge cock you're putting in your mouth.
Oh man.
So we got Flash today and then miscellaneous stuff, so
mm-hmm.
what do you want to do first?
It doesn't matter to me. I mean, we could, I think last time we did Flash first. If you want us, we could switch it up or
okay. What do you got?
I got a few different things. I read some more Wolverine and I read three more issues of Wolverine, and then I got some three individual old DC stories that I read, because I've had that greatest team up stories ever told trade,
yeah,
or hardcover for a while now. So, and those are all kind of done in one, so I figured I'd pick that up and start kind of like you do, like where you have stuff around that you haven't gotten around to read, kind of use the story as a chance, or use the podcast as a chance to get yourself to get through those, you know?
Yeah, the only thing is that's bad about that is you've said, I haven't read this, I feel like reading it. Like, every week I struggle with, there's so much good stuff that I want to read.
Yeah.
And I can only read some. And right. I was like, I struggle with what, but then I start reading it, and I was like, it like spawns me to buy more shit. I'm like... It's like a circle of hell.
Yeah. It's easy to get, like, when you're doing a little bit of research or and you're coming across other stuff. Like, you know, I was looking up some information on Mike's World of Comics about, you know, one of the, because I was about to read something else from Epic, which, you know, probably I'll get to that eventually, but, and I was looking up, you know, what came out around that time, and I, you know, I'll end up discovering something I never heard of. Some other, you know, came across some other Epic comic that I didn't know existed. That was like just an 8-issue run or something that looked interesting. And so the next thing I know, I'm looking it up on Comic Collector Live, seeing, you know, how much people have it for. And but yeah, it's easy to go down that spiral.
Mm-hmm. I did this last time.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I could kick it off with one of those DC stories I read.
Sure.
These are kind of around the same era as the Flash stuff, pretty close. But the first one was it originally appeared in Superman number 88, March of 1954.
Can I guess what it might be?
Sure.
I mean, I'm just guessing based on what you're reading.
Right.
Not based on time frame, but is it the Flash and the Superman?
No, this is actually, it starts off with a, it's actually a supervillain team up.
Oh, wow.
the very first story in the hardcover is a supervillain trio. It's or team up. It's the Terrible Trio, and it is Lex Luthor, the Toy Man, and the Prankster.
Oh God!
Teaming up against Superbad. These first few stories in this book are pretty freaking silly.
Well, it's odd, like. I would see the Toy Man and the Prankster teaming up, like, because that's like a done deal.
Right.
But Luthor to me is more like, he's so much more methodical and logical than those other two.
Yeah, this is the pencils in this are by Wayne Boring.
Yeah.
And I guess it was written by William Woolfolk. It's got a cartoony kind of style to it, and it's especially the Prankster. But his Lex Luthor looks like what's his name? Kojak.
Telly Savalas.
Yeah, Telly Savalas. He looks a lot like Telly Savalas. But it's a weird, like, it takes them one page to team up. They're all for some reason at different parts of a amusement park on the outside of Metropolis, and like the Prankster's looking at himself in funhouse mirrors, the Toy Man's riding the merry-go-round, and then you have Lex Luthor who's in the shooting gallery. But somehow it doesn't even really show how they all end up on this this slide that takes them down into like some underground area, and so they meet up and decide to team up against Superman. You know, and it's just like they each take a turn, basically. I mean, they work together, but they each take a turn planning the heist. And you know, like there's the Prankster goes first, or the Toy Man, one of the two. He has like a fake hat that lets out gas. And they try to steal something from a from this what is it, a jewelry store or something like that. But one of my favorite parts was they throw a grenade, and so it's heading towards this woman, and Superman flies in and grabs the grenade with his mouth. He can't get away in time, you know, like to fly it in outer space like he does with a lot of stuff. So he just swallows the grenade and lets it explode in his mouth. And he's, this is really funny panel where he's got this real goofy look on his face, and his cheeks are puffed out, and there's an explosion around. So, you know, it's like exploding in his mouth, and he's going, this flavor is delicious. But,
yeah, I'm looking at the cover right now, and that, like, the Toy Man looks like the Toy Man, Luthor looks like Luthor, but the Prankster isn't the one that I'm used to seeing. I'm used to seeing him without the hat, really fat and rounder, mm-hmm. with the green jacket.
Mm. Yeah, he's really, really goofy looking. He, actually, it cracked me up, when they first meet, Luthor says, "This chance meeting may be the luckiest thing that ever happened. What have you fellows been doing lately?" And the Prankster says, "Not much." I don't know why it was so funny to me, but it's just like, it's so casual.
Casual, like when we talk, what have you been doing? Not much.
Not much. But the Toy Man further explains that it's because Superman's always interfering with their plans, but Prankster seems a little slow. So then the Toy Man gets a turn. He has these crates delivered outside of there's a Jack in the Box contest, and these movers take them and leave them outside on the sidewalk, and the three of them are hidden inside the boxes, mm-hmm. with these spring-loaded platforms and that lets them jump in the third story window, and they're trying to break in this safe that that with the Toy Man's fake can opener, or it's like a toy can opener, but it's really a little torch.
Mm-hmm.
And each time Superman comes and breaks up their plan, and they use different vehicles of Luthor's to escape. Like the first time they use a jetmobile, and then the second time, all they're trying to do is break into the safe, and to escape, they use Luthor's like stratosphere rocket. So the guy owns a stratosphere rocket, and he's trying to help these other two guys break into a safe at a Jack in the Box contest.
Jesus, that's the one thing that old comics, the logic of some of the stuff they're doing with the brains they have, it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's pretty hilarious. So finally,
you're in Golden Age, actually. By the way, prior to that.
Right, yeah, right. So it'd be kind of like right before Silver Age, right?
Yeah, you're in Golden Age. 1954.
So finally, Luthor gets his chance, and his plan is suitably more grandiose. He's got these huge metal, they're like floating landmines, but they're humongous. Like one. He drops one over top of the U.S. Capitol building. It looks like this big floating alien spaceship kind of thing. There's one over the Eiffel Tower in tribute to DC Noise. So Superman ends up like knocking him into orbit and gets stuck on one of them, but he gets back in time. And then I like the way it ends. He shows up where the three of them are hanging out as he's flying in, and he grabs one of the drapes off the window that he flies in through, and he uses that to tie him up, and then he just flies away with the three of them on his back, tied together, like held together with the drape. And the prankster and the toy man don't even care that they're going to jail, because they're so happy that Luthor failed as well, that they're just cracking up at Luthor for messing up. And Superman says, "What a prize package of conceited hams these three are." So,
did it feel similar to the Silver Age, or was
no.
it? Did it feel it, distant?
It felt pretty Golden Age for the most part. I would say. I mean, I enjoy reading a Golden Age story once in a while just for the laughs. I mean, and just to see how different they are. I mean, it's not my favorite era in terms of if I'm going to really dig into a good story and stuff. You know, the Silver Age and the Flash stuff that we read, it still has some silliness and some logic problems, but there's enough of a connection to modern storytelling, you know? But seeing these, because they're characters, I think what keeps me connected is because they're characters that are still in existence today, and it's interesting to see how they were treated in a different era, you know? As opposed to reading, like, Golden Age stories about characters I've never heard of, you know?
Right.
There's nothing to really draw me in, but seeing how, you know, Luthor and Superman, these iconic characters, are still around today, seeing how they were written back then is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
In small doses.
Yeah, I think I'd have to do Golden Age in small doses.
Mm-hmm.
Or Silver Age, yeah. I think I could keep going. Like, the Flash stuff, I was like, well, I gotta go find the next trade.
Yeah, I was getting into that. I have volume 2, and I was I just actually this morning popped on Amazon and ordered 3 and 4 just to have them, you know, cuz
yep. See that proves the point of
yep.
something you like, it spawns you to buy more stuff.
Yeah, well, it motivated me, and definitely stuff I'd want to have in my collection anyways, because Flash is a favorite, so.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, that's true.
I wonder if I'm saving the best for last. Maybe I should save the best for last, because I read the Great Darkness Saga.
Oh.
So I'll save that for last. But I read from first comic, Star Slayer, The Log of the Jolly Roger. And oh, nice. This is number 19. I started right out in the middle of the freaking story because that's that's what I had that I had. I was missing this issue, and I just decided to read it. Mm. But this was originally a Mike Grell creation, and they said that he created it to kind of be like Warlord, except a little bit different. Because in Warlord, you have a pilot in the Air Force that's flying over Antarctica, and he ends up in the Middle Earth. And it's kind of like sorcery and sword and sorcery. Well, this is the opposite. It's if you took somebody from kind of like Arrak, Exo Man of War, if you took somebody from the past, like a Celtic warrior, and he was fighting the Romans, and put him into the future. So that's the backstory of what he is. He seems like he's like some type of pirate, and in this story, it's really hard to get into because it's already like midstream. What I did, I found an article that was kind of interesting. It was somebody who an Air Force sergeant stationed in Berlin, and he was just talking. The thing I found interesting about this article is, even though it's this is like 1984, it's still relevant to today. Like, it seems like this sergeant is into like the types of comics that are like indie now, or like the outer rim of DC or Marvel, you know, like Epic or any of that kind of stuff. And he's like, he's really enjoying like. Well, he is liking Thor from Simonson, and he's like all over the place. Fleming and Von Eden's Thriller, and then Capital's Badger, and Nathal Dusk from DC. You know, so he's like reading everything, and he's talking about how much he's loving this book. Like he loved issue number 14, and he's saying that he's reading a lot of like articles and moaning and groaning about people that are going to leave the book when Mike Grell leaves, because he stepped down. In this particular issue, it was Ostrander and Timothy Truman. You know, no joke. These guys are awesome just as well.
Yeah.
Mike Grell is the creator. But it just goes to show, like, that all that whining and shit you hear on the, you know, the internets now because it's so instant. It was happening back then, but via fan mail.
Yeah. It was just probably easier to ignore.
Yeah. But this guy's got a cool little spaceship, and there's this other huge spaceship. I forget what they call it. If I find it, I'll let you know. But this guy is like hunting Star Slayer. But Star Slayer in this one actually has meaning, because Star Slayer is a missile. Like it's a missile that they can launch into the core of a sun and destroy a whole galaxy. And Star Slayer kind of has no mercy because he's being hunted by this dude. And he just decides, fuck it. I have this Star Slayer. He's near the sun. I'm just going to launch this thing into the sun and destroy everything. So he goes to like a world and says, you know, like one of the worlds, and says, you got to get out of here because you're my friend. I'm going to blow up the whole fucking galaxy. He doesn't give a shit. And he's got like... It's pretty cool because he's on the ship doing... I saw some analogies between this and Star Trek, the new movie, but he's kind of on the other ship sabotaging it while his crew is getting ready to launch the rocket into the sun, and they do launch it. And they have a bird of prey. A matter of fact, I think their ship is called a Raptor, and it's like a bird of prey, and it's hunting them, and... They actually managed to escape Star Slayer's, like, pretty much... Man, there's a lot of analogies between this and the new Star Trek movie. The Star Slayer imagines he escapes, and the dude that was after him and the other rocket ship ends up dying. But it was a good issue, and man, Timothy Truman's art is so freaking awesome. So like I love Mike Grell, but man, I am gonna seek these issues out. Story wise, it was pretty interesting, but not as much as I like the art. The art was fantastic, and it's on the paper that I love. And this was 1984 paper, and I read a 1990 paper, and I love the way this paper is as opposed to 1990, because 1990 you still had the same type of paper, but damn, they had like video game ads everywhere with a lot of darks, and what those caused is like a weird black tint across the white paper because the ink bled over.
Oh.
Because of the extreme amounts of blacks they used.
Mm-hmm.
But this was really good. I liked it. And then they had a little story in there about, I guess they're going through the approved by Comics Code. And you've talked about the Comics Code in the past. So this is, you know, took about the Wortham and the juvenile delinquents and how it was interesting how Wortham based all his facts on, he didn't have like a good study group when he was basing his scientific facts on. He basically went to the sane asylums and the jails where these kids were and said, well, did you read comic books? And yeah. They were like, yeah, I read comic books. Okay, that's what I'm basing my facts on. But what he didn't understand where his thing is flawed is that billions, and they were selling billions of comic books at that time. They were saying in 1950s at 10 cents a copy, annual sales were totaling about $100 million. That's a lot of money for 1950. Mm-hmm. Like that's how much the industry was bringing in, $100 million. Holy crap. So, yeah, this was an interesting article. And he said even prior to that, there was another, before the code came, there was an Association of Comics Magazine Publishers tried to form some kind of code. But DC, Dell, Disney, and Fawcett all failed to, you know, they refused to participate in it. So that one never took off.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the whole video game violence thing nowadays. You know, with you take a small sample size, and yeah, I mean, these juvenile delinquents happen to have read comics, but everybody is reading comics, you know, so it doesn't really, and you know, it's like, well, kids that perpetrate violence, yeah, they're playing violent video games, but so is everybody else.
So is everybody else. That's why you need two study groups. You need the case of the kids that don't play video games, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that do, and then see what you can find from that.
Yeah.
These kids don't play video. You won't be able to find that, but at least it'd be hard to.
Yeah. So it's kind of crazy, but.
But yeah. It was a good comic, and again, I am really interested. I mean, the reason I have Star Slayer in my collection is strictly because I was a Rocketeer fan. And I went and bought back issues just to complete my Rocketeer because Rocketeer is a backup feature, Dave Stevens' backup in Star Slayer. So the only issues I own of Star Slayer are Rocketeer issues. Well, this one was just a full issue of Star Slayer.
Mm-hmm.
And the article that was written by Charles Mayerson, I guess he was a radio DJ at WXRT Radio in Chicago. So that's interesting as well.
Yeah.
And the other thing that was going on in First at that time was American Flag, which I've never read. But in my latest DCBS order, I noticed they were offering the Omnibus hardcover and the Volume 2 Omnibus. And I went ahead and bought them because I am loving Chaykin, so I figure I might as well go get one of Chaykin's most prized works.
Nice. And that, have you read that before, or?
Have I? No, I haven't. So all that right. That's going to be fun for me.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I haven't read any Star Slayer. I have, I think, one issue or something that I picked up to try at some point, because I was seeing in other stuff I was reading from First Comics, I was seeing ads for it with Mike Grellart, and I forget, there's the one female character, I don't know who she is in the story and stuff, but she wears that outfit. It's basically just a bunch of like black strips of clothing.
Yeah.
I forget who she is, but
oh, are you talking about Warlord or Star Slayer?
No, Star Slayer. Yeah, Star Slayer.
In this one, there was a blonde one, and then there was a brunette, but she did not wear skimp. She was in a spacesuit most of the time.
Yeah, well, and I think these were ads for the series debut, so she might have been a character more in the beginning of the...
Different artists, too, so...
Different artists, yeah. It was when...
Tim Truman, I'll put some more clothes on her. It's more practical. My girl is like, take it off. Because my girl used to draw that one girl in Skitaris that was that one chick that could change into a black cat. I don't know if you've read any Warlord, but she had the skimpiest outfit ever.
No, I got more interested in Warlord from, you know, checking out some of his other stuff, like reading those issues of John Sable stuff, and also, you know, from Green Arrow. Made me want to go back and try it at some point. But yeah, he usually fits in a scantily clad female if he can.
Yeah. And Star Slayer's known too because it launched Grimjack, which is probably a more popular property than Star Slayer. And also Rocketeer, which is pretty popular today.
Yeah.
I think Rocketeer's more popular today than it ever was. Because, yeah, when the movie came out, it was pretty doggone popular, but nobody knew there was a comic book. And right. It was really hard to find because Dave Stevens published, like, this is a backup feature, so you only got, like, 8 pages. And then you have to wait 10 years to get the rest of the story. So it was like you had to seek out, like, 3 different titles over the course of a decade to get Rocketeer comics.
Yeah.
Three different companies.
Yeah.
So.
Which, I mean, the average consumer that saw the movie, you know, they're not even usually, you know, going to go into like a specialty comic shop in the first place, you know.
Yeah, they don't
seek something out. So, if you're not going to make it easy for them. I mean, I remember seeing the movie when I was younger, and liking it and not realizing. I knew it seemed, you know, I had comic book aspects to it. I didn't realize till later on that it was actually, you know, that the comics came first or that they were it was based on comics. I just knew it seemed like a comic-esque story, you know. Mm-hmm. But, the next team-up story I read was from World's Finest, issue 82. See what this is from a couple years after the other one, from May June of 1956, and the title kind of tells you what it's about. It's called The Three Super Musketeers, and this one was by Edmund Hamilton, and possessor of one of the greatest names ever, artist was Dick Sprang. So this is Superman and Batman and Robin. And again, this one's pretty crazy, pretty silly. This I guess at the time Batman and Robin were sent into the past pretty often by Dr. Carter Nichols. And he's a historian and scientist in Gotham, and he basically solves riddles of history by sending Batman and Robin into the past to investigate it. And Clark Kent's covering he's covering the press conference, you know, that Dr. Nichols is giving. So he becomes interested and heads over to Wayne Manor and flies in through the chimney. and because he's interested in going with them. So they're sent back to 1696 in France. And as soon as they get there, they run into D'Artagnan, yeah, I know it's saying that wrong. They run into D'Artagnan, and the Three Musketeers are in pretty rough shape. So so Batman, Robin, and Superman take the place of the Three Musketeers, and they do so by borrowing their hats and swords, boots, and cloaks, but they put them on over their costumes. So Superman's still got his red cape flying out behind him, and Batman looks the most ridiculous because he still has his cowl on.
Yeah.
But then he's got this Three Musketeer hat on over top of his cowl. He looks fucking ridiculous. It's pretty awesome. So they attack the castle of where Bourdais is they're trying to find out who is the man in the Iron Mask, and the man in the Iron Mask is in this castle. So they show up, and Superman, so they think he's the Musketeer Porthos. Superman just kind of walks up, stands in front of the drawbridge, and they shoot cannonballs at him, and they bounce off his chest. And they're like, holy shit, and he catches one of the cannonballs and throws it to snap the chains holding the drawbridge, which is pretty badass. And he walks up the drawbridge and tears apart the gates that are, the iron grating behind them. So that lets them in. They find the man in the Iron Mask, but Bourdais leads them out and threatens to shoot the man in the Iron Mask if they do anything further. So that allows them to escape, and he leaves our three super musketeers and D'Artagnan chained up, and Superman waits to break them out until the bad guys have left, so that they don't shoot the man in the Iron Mask. So basically they have to pursue them and head towards Versailles. The bad guys still think that it's the real Three Musketeers, so they keep they think Batman and Robin are Athos and Aramis, and Batman and Robin are being chased, so they do this trick where they rip some branches off the trees above them as they're galloping along on their horses, and they set the branches up in front of them on the horse and put their hats and cloaks on the branches, and then so the horses keep going. It looks like from a distance that they're still on their horses, and they jump up into the trees and wait till their pursuers pass under them and knock them off of their horses. So the good thing about that is that means that they are actually out of their ridiculous get-ups and just in their normal costumes, no more hat there. and they break into the palace, and we get another funny sequence where Batman uses his disguise skills, and he adopts the identity of the king of France, because when they show up, they're wanting to help the king, or, you know, let them know what this Bordeaux guy is up to. And as soon as they land inside the palace, the king rushes at them with a rapier, thinking that they're assassins. But they just jump out of the way, and the king knocks himself out against the door by smacking his head against it. So he's out cold, and that allows Batman to use his skills of disguise to impersonate the king, and he puts his Batman costume on the king. And it's funny because it's like the way that it's drawn, you know, he's got some pretty good skills because he looks identical to the king once he's done there, because they're drawn exactly the same. So, you know, eventually, Bordeaux knows that, that time is running out. So he decides that he's going to try to kill the man in the iron mask. So he fills up the guy's cell with all this water, and, somehow he survives, right? And so then they decide to just, wall up his, cell, you know, with bricks, and as soon as they're done, the wall busts open, and so then they just go and they're like, we're just gonna, you know, stop messing around, we're gonna just stab the guy to death, and all their swords just break on his chest, and they so Batman and the king and Robin get there, and they like, what the hell's going on here? And they lift the iron mask, and it's Superman underneath. And he switched place with the guy that was under there, which was Count Fernie. And he's like, so Batman's still described as the king. And so then you have, like, the king in the Batman costume saying, I'm the king. And let's change our clothes back, good Batman. So then the next panel says, and after changing in another room, we have the king and the Batman back in their respective get-ups. And the D'Artagnan wants them to stay and continue to fight with them. But as they're talking, they're fading out as Dr. Nichols is bringing them back. And somehow, as they're being transferred through time, they change back into their secret identities, and they're able to reveal that the man in the iron mask was switched to Bordeaux. That was his new imprisonment, so that's why there was always a man in the iron mask, because it was actually a new prisoner that was switched into it at the last minute. The end.
That sounds interesting, but I'm a Three Musketeer fan, so.
Ah, okay. So that's up your alley.
Yeah, it's up my alley. It sounds goofy, though. I don't know if the period.
Yeah, it was really goofy.
That writing would have worked for me. I don't know. I haven't explored a lot of Golden Age, so we'll see. It's just based on what I have read.
Yeah, I got a kick out of how funny it was, and you know, just seeing the three superheroes, you know, dressed up, maintaining their secret identities in the, you know, 1600s.
the fact that nobody cared, that nobody noticed anything different.
Yeah.
Why is that guy wearing a cowl underneath his hat?
Yeah. That's pretty awesome.
So my next book, I'm trying to do, like, a little bit of DC, a little bit of Marvel, and a little bit of indie lately. So yeah. My next one, because we're so focused on DC the rest of this podcast, I picked one Marvel. And this is going to jump us forward into the 90s for a bit. New Mutants number 88 with a $1 cover price. This is around the time where Cable and Liefeld were doing stuff.
All right.
So we have Louise Simonson as the writer, Rob Liefeld as the penciler, Hillary Barda as the inker, who we hear a lot of today. Bob Harris is the editor, who's now at DC. And Tom DeFalco, who's the editor-in-chief, who's now at DC.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and Superboy and stuff. This was really interesting. I kind of jumped off of New Mutants. Like, I don't have a full run of New Mutants, but lately, I'd have to say that Cable is, like, one of my favorite X-Men. Like hardcore. And I do have all of Liefeld's X-Force, but I didn't have what led up to X-Force. So I figured I want to learn more about Cable, so I'll jump into that time period. So, you know, I have some spots in the New Mutants that I'm trying to fill that have Cable in them. And I filled most of them, and I said, well, maybe I ought to read it because I haven't read this stuff. But I like Liefeld's art, especially now. I mean, especially his older stuff. I think he's gone very loose in his style. Like, he used to have so much more detail. Mm-hmm. And it could be that Hilary Barta was inking him.
Maybe.
So maybe he was as loose, and Hilary Barta's like making that look really detailed.
Right.
But I guess during this time period, there was a Mutant Liberation Front, and there was the Freedom Force. And the Freedom Force was interesting. It had like Crimson somebody. I can't remember the rest of his name. Commando. Crimson Commando. Pyro. The Blob. Mm-hmm. Somebody Sabre. I don't know how to pronounce that. Do you pronounce it Sabre or Sabre?
Sabre,
even though it's B-R, I mean, B-R-E. Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. So Sabre. They had,
I only know that because of the Buffalo Sabres.
Yeah, so he actually runs really fast. Silver, I think his name was Silver. So he has, they work for the government, so you have all these villains that are trying to convince Cable to join this Freedom Force to work for the government, and Mystique is part of it.
Yeah, because that was originally like Mystique's like plot in Uncanny X-Men was she started the Freedom Force, and they were supposed to be, it was kind of like a cover up pretending to work for the government.
Yeah,
that like changed over time, I think.
Yeah. And I loosely remember this. I wasn't reading as much X-Men books as you were, but I have read some of it, like mostly Uncanny, mostly the main titles.
Yeah.
And one thing that I could see just by reading this book is that the universe in 1990 was very tightly coupled. So, like, mm-hmm. if you were reading this book, New Mutants, you might also want to be reading X-Factor. You might also want to be reading X-Men. There's like a union there between all books, and there's a lot of references going on. In this particular issue, 88, X-Factor, which was, you know, Cyclops, Marvel Girl, and Beast, and Iceman, all the Angel, Archangel, all the major players were coming out from outer space. Coming back to Earth, and then on Earth you had the New Mutants, and they were returning from Asgard. So, mm-hmm. and Dainey had just stayed there, and then you got this plot with Cable, who's going to probably form the more New Mutants. But
mm-hmm.
Boom Boom is still Boom Boom. I she's always trying to wear skimpy outfits and. And she was trying to appeal to this one guy with a mohawk. I don't know his name, but I want to say Richter, but maybe it's not Richter. He wore like a vest with no shirt and just pants. And then she was real jealous because he was always around Rain, and he would treat Boom Boom like a big sister. Mm. And it would piss her off because she didn't want to be treated like a sister. She wanted to flirt with them and do stuff with them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there was a lot of interesting things. So it was Cable fighting Freedom Force, or trying to escape the government, and he did get away. The Blob almost killed him. I mean, it seems like the Blob is like really powerful. Like, Cable's like got his big old gun, and he's like shooting him, and he's like, "You can't hurt me." And the cave decides to light him on fire, and the bot panics for a minute, and he's like, well, you can't do anything to me. Fire ain't going to bother me. Bob. Yeah, he disabled the rest of them pretty quickly, though. And then Mystique is going back after him, so that's pretty much it. But a lot of things happening during this time period.
Yeah, so that was kind of, it sounds like that was kind of a transition between the old team and what ended up becoming X-Force then.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was
87 might have been the first appearance of Cable, or maybe it was one of those. Like,
yeah, because it's pretty close to the end there.
It's pretty close. But
I remember, man, those issues, those last issues of New Mutants were such a huge deal when I was a kid and collecting. Mm-hmm. You know, and the debut of X-Force was just, we were so excited about X-Force number one.
Yeah. I liked X-Force number one. being that a lot of people shit on it today, I enjoyed that run. If you read it in chunks, you could see a lot of plot layers being built. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of drama.
Well, I haven't gone back and read them, but I can see how, I mean, I'll totally admit that I was a big Liefeld fan when I was a kid, and that I really don't care for his art anymore. But I can see how, just by the nature of, like you said, that, you know, it was getting towards the end of it being a tighter continuity mm-hmm. in the X universe, but it still was, you know, and a lot of that was the legacy of, you know, when you only had two books. And both of them were written by Chris Claremont, and then, you know, you had the involvement of Louise Simonson, who was the was his editor for a while, so she was really comfortable and familiar with the universe, and everything was, you know, so you kind of, I guess what I'm saying is, like, you know, New Mutants and X-Force could benefit from the fact that everything was had a tight continuity, so you had a lot of different crossover and interesting things happening. The other books would bleed over, you know.
Yeah, you could definitely see that here. There was one thing I wanted to ask you though. I don't know if you're going to remember this, but the way the last few pages were, and it made me really curious because Rain came back, you know, from Asgard, mm-hmm. and the first thing she did was call her stepmom, I guess, the one who adopted her, Maura McTaggart,
mm-hmm.
who's like a scientist and helps mutants and all that. And right. I know that. But when she called her, she was wearing like this bikini top with these, like, she looked like Emma Frost. She had this haircut like she was like a Donna Matrix. And the New Mutants like were like, what the hell? You know, why does she look so different? And then Rain is like, hey, I got back. I'm with my family. Everything's good. And then she's like, you need to come home now. I can't put up with this crap. And I was wondering if you knew why she was evil. Did she have an evil period of time?
Moira?
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to say, I don't know if that was the case then, but I want to say that she was possessed by somebody.
Charles Xavier's son? What is his name? I can't remember.
Legion?
I don't know. Maybe. I'm just guessing. But even the New Mutants were like, man, something's not right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, why does she look like Emma Frost? Why is she acting the way she's acting? And she's basically going to get Rain, and maybe if I have issue 89, I'll go figure. I find myself actually drawn into the soap opera-ness of a lot of comics, more so than them fighting the villains and stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but it was a good issue. I liked it.
No, I mean, that was a lot of times the thing. You know, occasionally you get a good villain or a good adversary, but a lot of times, really, it is the soap opera aspect of the relationships between all the different characters and stuff that's really the draw, you know?
Yeah.
I think she might have been possessed by the Shadow King.
Okay. It makes sense.
That's what I want to say. Because I think that was right around. I think that was the right time.
I will say this though, the art was really nice, and I I didn't so much mind the feet. So, I can see how he likes to draw boots and stuff. Like, if Liefeld tried to draw like toes, I can't imagine him succeeding. And I think that's why his feet look the way they do, but it doesn't look bad. Although the pose that Boom Boom's in is really weird.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't have too much good to say about him. I mean, my theory is that he had, you know, raw talent, and he became popular so fast that he never really had to develop that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying he has no skill, but it's just if normally you have to really work your way up and you have to, like, you know, take feedback and you have to take criticism and you have to work and develop your skills so that people will take you seriously. But he didn't have to go through any of that, you know?
And that's why he comes across as like a little kid when he's professionally, when people put him down.
Yeah.
He doesn't like to take criticism. I will say he created a lot. For the short time he created stuff, mm-hmm. he created a lot of freaking characters.
Yeah.
Artistically.
A number of them are kind of, you know, ripoffs of other characters, though. And I think that what annoys me sometimes, I feel like he'll take credit for the popularity of characters that he created, but the reason that they're popular
are because of the writers like Alan Moore and...
Yeah, what people did to them later, like Deadpool.
Yeah.
You know, Deadpool was just the generic assassin. I mean, we thought he was awesome, you know, back in the day. And I will say that his costume was cool and stuff, but there was really nothing to him. And then, you know, his popularity today is totally because of what other writers came along and like picked up and did with the character.
Yeah.
But you listen to him sometimes, it's like, you know, the reason that Deadpool's so popular today, it's all due to him.
Yeah.
But
I think if he was more, even if he thought that way, if he wasn't so vain about everything.
Yeah.
He might be more well liked.
Oh, totally. You know, yeah.
Because he did a lot. I mean, he did do a lot in a short amount of time, so.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's...
And then he was, he was one of the founding fathers of Image to break mm-hmm. away from the big two, so that was a big thing at the time. You're leaving a paycheck and starting on your own and making more millions, so.
Yeah, I mean, if you're arrogant and shit on other creators, then... No one's going to want to, you know, give you the benefit of the doubt, you know?
Yeah.
So.
But anyway, dense comic, but I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of material there, a lot going on. It took me at least 25 minutes or 30 minutes to read, whereas a typical comic today is 15
or 10,
you know? And that's pausing for the... art.
And Louise Simonson, I mean, I've heard interviews with her and she seems
she's fucking really, awesome. Yeah, I've met her at cons and stuff.
You? Yeah.
Oh shit, yeah. She's like, "You want a picture? Sure." And she's so nice.
Yeah, oh man, like just
she's always smiling too. Like mm-hmm. you never see her like pissed or anything. Like, cause cons could be stressful, I guess, but she's just a happy person. She shows that she's a happy person.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was an Uncanny X-Cast interview that I heard with her.
Oh, that was amazing. That was great. Great
interview. Yes, and it really comes across in that interview, like, what an awesome person she is. She just sounds like she'd be really cool to hang out with.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so.
And I'm not a fan of interview podcasts. I don't know why. But I really enjoyed that one.
Well, it all depends. A lot of it depends on who's being interviewed, you know. And not everybody is that interesting. You know, the stuff that they created might be interesting, but they themselves, you know, might not be the most interesting person to talk to, you know.
Yeah.
But
this wasn't really promoting anything. I mean, she had her new X Factor book, that X Factor Forever, that she was talking briefly about, but she was really talking about the past and all that stuff. So it was interesting.
If anyone out there that's interested in that era of X-Men and her involvement and stuff, you know, even if you didn't like what she wrote, I think it would still be an interesting interview, because she, you know, really talks about sort of, you know, the behind the scenes of her involvement and how she went from editing to writing, and her relationship with, you know, Chris Claremont and how they worked and stuff. So pretty interesting stuff.
Yep.
So I guess I'll jump over. So I'll stay on the Marvel kick, and I'll jump over and I'll just talk about some more Wolverine real quick. And you know, last time I talked about issues 1 through 3 of the of his first ongoing series, and I liked them enough that I wanted to keep reading. And I was surprised I liked them that much. I just didn't really remember. I remembered liking them when I was younger, and just didn't really remember what the character of them were. But I really love, I'm finding this stuff really holds up, and I really love this era of Wolverine. I love him as Patch, and just having him be a little bit more subtle and undercover. And it really continues to have, in these, I read 4, 5, and 6, and these issues continue to have a real, like, you know, master of Kung Fu kind of feel to them. This storyline involves Karma, speaking of the New Mutants, who was an early New Mutant and left the team. And her uncle is making a play for control of the gangs in Madripoor. Currently, the gangs are pretty much controlled by this woman named Tiger, with a Y instead of an I. And her uncle is basically sees an opportunity, and he employs these two guys, Roughhouse and Bloodsport. And Roughhouse is a big bruiser kind of fellow, and Bloodsport is a sort of vampire, and he can kind of, if he gets a taste of somebody's blood, he can kind of exert influence over them, puts like a mark on them. And we still have involvement of Lindsay and Jessica Drew. They haven't headed back home yet after their involvement in the first storyline, and they get drawn in again. To help Wolverine, Wolverine wants Tiger to remain in control, because even though she's a gang leader, she refrains from a lot of the more destructive elements, and Karma's uncle wants to, you know, bring in a lot of drugs and more darker crimes. So it's kind of a lesser of two evils kind of thing. So he convinces Lindsay and Jessica to protect Tiger while. In issue 5, him and this guy Archie Corrigan go after Karma's uncle's drug crops, you know, to sort of hit his supply, you know, like I said, a lot of it's pretty subtle. There is an action sequence where Wolverine gets pretty Wolverine-ish by jumping out of the plane that him and Archie Corrigan are in. They're being pursued by another plane. So he jumps out of their plane, unsheaths his claws, and cuts the wing off of the other plane and then does like a swan dive into a nearby lake. But so while they're doing that, while they're taking out Karma's uncle's drug crop, Lindsay and Jessica are trying to protect Tiger, and they're found by Roughhouse and Bloodsport, and taken. So in issue 6, Karma, meanwhile, she's been kind of coerced into helping her uncle against her own better judgment, and she's had a couple encounters with Wolverine at this point. She doesn't know that he's Wolverine. She doesn't know that he has a connection to the X-Men, and he pretends to not recognize her as one of the New Mutants. So, you know, he's kind of at times kind of put the thought into her head, you know, like, you need to be on the, you need to get right back on the better path here. So when we get to issue 6, it starts off with Karma breaking into the palace of the Prince of Madripoor, who, you know, is kind of connected to the crime in the area, and whoever he kind of puts his favor on, ultimately is the one that's allowed to control the gangs and stuff. And Koi, Karma's uncle Koi, he's at this point gotten pretty in with the prince, and is in the palace with Lindsay and Jessica and Tiger and Bloodsport and Roughhouse, and Karma's breaking in, and Wolverine and Archie are also breaking in at the same time. So Wolverine finds Karma and makes her come with him. Most of issue 6 is a huge battle between all those people I just mentioned. It's well done. It's a good, nice, exciting battle sequence between all these different players. And Tiger is using this containment suit that protects her and gives her some actual power, since she's normal human. Lindsay kind of stays out of it, but Jessica Drew, even though she's not acting as Spider-Woman, still has powers, some of her powers. And the battle kind of gets close to resolving itself, and the actual prince shows up at the end of the issue. So next, and it teases that the Hulk is going to be showing up, but at this time it's the Gray Hulk, and he's also undercover as Mr. Fix-It. So, you know, we get Wolverine and Hulk in kind of a different, instead of upcoming issues, instead of their normal, like, antagonistic relationship, we got them as Patch and Mr. Fix-It kind of in a more cooperative relationship. So,
is that issue 7 or?
Yeah, 7 and 8. I think Hulk's in.
Did you read those too, or?
Not yet, no.
Oh.
Those are like favorites. I can't remember who had issue 7, but issue 8 was a highly traded issue between me and my friend.
I asked Hulk and Wolverine on the cover and white jackets.
Yeah, we, especially for the cover, and the fact that the Hulk was in it. But yeah, the early issues of Wolverine, I'm finding that they're really holding up. Same as issues 1 through 3, these were written by Chris Claremont and with art by John Buscema, and I really like the Buscema art in these issues. It's really suits the kind of B martial arts movie kind of noir feel of the books. It's really cool, so I'm glad I'm going back and checking these out, because it's been a long time since I've really felt like a Wolverine fan, and you know, I haven't really read much Wolverine in a while, and it reminds me of when the Wolverine world was kind of simpler and there was more mystery to, you know, his background, and I always liked him undercover as Patch. I think it's cool.
I know you're reading these digitally, but are you using an iPad or a computer?
I've been reading them on the computer.
Mm.
Kara has an iPad. And I also, I installed the app now that there is an app for the iPad and the iPhone. I installed the app on my iPhone, but when I've, anytime I've gone to read something on there, it takes a while for the comic to load up and I get impatient. But it works pretty nice on the computer. It's not my preferred way to read them. It's not, I wouldn't go on like a marathon of reading like 20 issues of, or something in a row, but reading like three or so, it's not too bad.
Cool deal. I guess I'll. Do you want to talk about that last greatest team up that you read real quick, or?
I can save it. Or
okay.
It's not a big deal. So if you want to talk about Darkness Saga.
All right. So I'll finish this up with the Great Darkness Saga, which ran issues. This is interesting because when I bought this trade, I guess I didn't realize how little of Darkseid I would see. Because I remember reading the Darkness Saga, but I remember reading like two or three issues. And this is this has got like 12 issues in it, plus an annual.
Mm-hmm.
So they really, with when they put together this package, they really put together a good package because it basically started with hints all the way back in 84. And then you get hinted for like 10 issues that something's going on and the darkness is coming back and you don't know what really happening.
And yeah, then you get Darkseid. I remember reading reviews of that trade, and they talked about how it, you know, they include a lot of other issues beyond just what you might consider to be the main issues of the Darkness Saga.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I mean, it was mostly Paul Levitz, Keith Giffen, and Larry Malstedt, but there was a couple of other artists at the beginning, like Pat Broderick, and a lot of really cool stuff. I learned a hell of a lot about Legion. Like, I've been reading DC Comics for a long, long time, but I think the weakest superhero property that I'm in is Legion. In other words, every other property I know really, 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 really well, and I own a lot of issues. I don't own a lot of issues of Legion. I've kind of been Legion, minus the last 10 years. Last 10 years, I've been reading Legion pretty religiously, and maybe that's why I like this so much, because I see relationships there now, and I see how they were formed in the past, and they're still there. So I like that aspect of it. I learned a heck of a lot. Like, I learned a lot about their inner workings and who is having relationships with who and that kind of thing. I learned that Dream Girl was a head of Legion at one time. And I learned that when they have these votes for who's going to lead Legion, like, they used to involve the, you know, it was like call or send us a letter and vote yourself, that kind of thing. But the weird thing with Dream Girl is once you put that as a plot point, how the hell can you get out of it other than you say she's running just and she knows she's going to lose because she can project the future. Well, she obviously saw she was going to win. She was going against Ultra Boy and Element Lad. And Element Lad is that curly-haired guy that kind of looks like Kirk's son in the third Star Trek. And he really wanted that position because he was deputy for many, many years, or two or three years. He was backup. You know, he was always the backup dude. And he actually took the leadership when Lightning Lad totally lost his fucking marbles in this book. I don't know what the fuck is. He went through some like crisis of faith, and he couldn't deal with anything anymore, and became emotionally unstable, and he just had a wicked downfall. I never realized he was such a pansy or had such a bad time, because every time I've seen him, he was one of the main Legionnaires. He was
Yeah, he was one of the founders.
Pretty stoic, and he was very unstable at this time. And his sister, Lightning Lass, very much the same. Lightning Lass was dating Timberwolf. And the other thing I learned is that Timberwolf used to be like, he used to look like Wolverine. And then he went and got reconstructive surgery to look more like Colossus Boy. I don't know. He looks, or Karate Kid. He got facial reconstruction so he didn't look like an animal anymore. And he did that, I think, for Light Lass because she wanted him to have that. Matter of fact, it was coincidental that in one issue they're like, there's some villains that are trying to steal stuff or drugs from a hospital while Karate Kid is getting his facial treatment. And they have to actually send out Legionnaires to help, like Wildfire and Dawnstar. And it's cool how you see Wildfire and Dawnstar's relationship build, because I saw that in Legion Lost in the New 52 too. And then you got Princess Projectra dating Karate Kid. And her claim to fame is weird. Is like she can project images, but I guess once you see that all she's doing is doing projections, how much value is that?
Yeah.
I mean, I can see how it could work good in like missions where people can't tell real from, but when you're fighting, oh my God, you're in trouble. But it was interesting because Princess Projectra and Karate Kid went back to her planet. And they were visiting her dad, and Karate Kid was going to ask her father for permission to marry her. And he dies.
Oh, yeah.
So Princess Projectra is going to get the mantle or become Queen Projectra. And the brother, I think it was the brother-in-law or whatever, wanted the throne. So he tries to kill Karate Kid and Princess Projectra and make them look like the bad guys. But that they overcame that, and all this happens. And then the other thing I liked about it was this was the origin of Invisible Kid, the new guy, the French guy. The original Invisible Kid died in I think Jim Shooter issues, and this one brought him. His sister was deathly ill, I mean on her deathbed, and he was going to Brainiac 5 for help, and Brainiac 5 was like, yeah, I can use this computer technology to try to bring her back because I'm using it on Matter Eater Lad. Matter Eater Lad's also in a weird coma state, and he's trying to help both of them at the same time. Well, using he unleashes computer on Legion, basically. Brainiac F's up. Computo takes over the whole damn building, and all hell breaks loose. And he becomes Invisible Kid because Brainiac 5 says, I have this formula from the original Invisible Kid. I need you to ingest it. And bang, just like that, Invisible Kid is part of Legion. He didn't have to go through any kind of training. He got the flight ring by default right off the bat.
Nice.
What other interesting things did I see in here? And meanwhile, they're building up Darkseid, and Darkseid is got minions, and you keep thinking to yourself, well, God dang, one of them's got to be Orion because he's got those astro glider things, you know, that he's always riding. So you get that, and then there's other ones. You find out one is like Superman. The other one is Lightning Lass's ancestor. So he's resurrecting these beings to fight for him and fight for the darkness. And then he's also, at the same time, going to Daxam and taking all the Daxamites and making him his legion. So you have a bunch of Superman-type powered beings released upon the entire universe, and they're going world to world and just taking over.
Nice.
And another cool thing is Block. They introduce the Green Lantern Corps, and at this time, Green Lantern Corps isn't even allowed on Earth. They're not even allowed to mess with anything. Mm. And one of the Green Lantern Corps is freaking Universo. At least it doesn't tell you if it's real Universo, but it implies that Block, through his research, found out that Universo was a Green Lantern. And nobody else had found out that. And all Block is saying, it can't be true because Brainiac 5 would have solved this a long time ago. But I think it is true. I think he is. And it's pretty awesome. High Father makes an appearance. Orion makes an appearance. They fight off Darkseid. All is restored. It's pretty cool. There was one issue that I think Keith Giffen wasn't inked by anybody, and it started to look like the Keith Giffen that we know.
Mm. Interesting.
Not the Kirby Keith Giffen, but the one that was kind of dark and line drawn. It was pretty cool. They bring in all kinds of other Legionnaires. I think DC had a book called The Wanderers. And one of them's a Kryptonian, and they introduce them because once Darkseid comes, all hell breaks loose, and they need help from everybody. Colossal Boy and Shrinking Violet have a relationship. That one's kind of really weird because you have somebody that can grow and one that can shrink. Sexual. It's got to be very interesting.
A lot of interesting varieties.
Yeah. The other relationship I think I've already mentioned is Timberwolf and Lightning Lass. And there's a scene where Saturn Girl is on an asteroid with Timberwolf, and they're hugging. And Saturn Girl's like, "I'm so glad that you're going to be with my sister-in-law because I see that I can read your minds, and I know that Lightning Lass loves you more than I have ever loved anybody," which means she doesn't love Lightning Lad as much. But that was awkward, and that awkwardness lasted about 10 issues, and then Lightning Lass gave Timberwolf the ultimatum, basically saying, "Leave Legion and go with me, or stay with Legion," and Timberwolf says, "Fuck you, I'm staying with Legion. Legion's my family." Mon-El and Shadow Lass have a relationship. Chameleon Boy finds out that his father is RJ Brand, and he wants to rebel, and he takes some Legions on a mission that he shouldn't be take him on, but because he's like one of the deputies, he could do it. And he almost gets them all killed. And he goes to jail for it. So much in this freaking book. I mean, that I learned, especially about the inner workings and personal relationships. The White Witch's powers are freaking awesome. I think without the White Witch, they would have never defeated Darkseid. But it's really good. This is something that deserves more than my coverage here. Like, it was maybe something we should have covered in the future because it's so good.
Yeah, I actually... So my history with the Legion was I had never read anything, and then the reboot by Abnett and Lanning was getting such good reviews that I decided to check it out and really got into it. And they did their own Dark Side story. And then I also, when they rebooted it again, I also was reading, the one that started off by Wade and, Kitson.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of had to adjust because I didn't realize at first that it was a total reboot. So I had to kind of adjust to, you know, the different differences and the different relationships and stuff like that. But last year I collected a bunch of older Legion stuff I haven't read yet, but you know, cause I didn't buy them all in one complete run. So I was filling in gaps and stuff, and I ended up, finishing up a run that starts with 259. That was the first issue that didn't, have Superboy in the title anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It was just Legion of Superheroes, and then it goes through to when it became Tales of Legion Superheroes for a while, like into like 320 something. So it includes, so I have all the actual issues in that trade, but I haven't read any of them yet.
Yeah, well, when you want to start, tell me the issues and I'll go seek them out. Because I want in on this.
Yeah, I read.
I've outsucked in the world. It caused me to buy another deluxe format book from this time period. I think it's the follow-on. And then I also bought Legion Lost, which is kind of Abnett and Lanning's kickoff book. So
that was a really good story.
Yeah, I'm sucked into this world, man. All that drama and history is just, I want to read more.
Yeah,
I really like the art in this time period too. Like what he was doing, I like it, and I want to see more Giffen because I'm a Giffen fan. So.
Mm-hmm.
I want to discover more of his art styles through the years.
Yeah, I did read a few of the, like, the first few issues of the run, like 259, 260s, early 260s. And it's interesting because the Legion was really in a sort of a state of flux as far as creative teams until Levitz got on the book in Giffen. Prior to that, like the issues I read, I think the first couple were written by Jerry Conway, and then, you know, like the artist keeps changing, and it was that way for a while, to the point that I remember reading some letters in the letters column that were addressing the fact that the artist kept changing, and like people were complaining about the creative team not being stable. And DC was kind of apologizing about that and explaining why it was, and that they were working on getting the team on there permanently. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of like flux and changes and stuff before they finally got the stability of Levitz and Giffen for a while.
I am also becoming a huge Levitz fan, like huge. even like the current New 52 Legion right now. Are you reading that now? The last few issues here?
No.
Oh, my God. For one thing, they had that the Kirby issues, the ones that look like Kirby, and it's almost like a Great Darkness Saga all over again.
Oh, cool.
Holy shit! There's, like, so much chaos and stuff going on. There's a Legionnaire dying every issue. I mean, you're like, holy crap! It is so awesome. I'm, like, sucked into it. I am loving it. I even finished my Legion Lost, and I mean the New 52 version, and I loved it. And I'm into the Legion right now. You go through phases, like right now you're rediscovering Wolverine, you know, and
right.
It's like you go through these phases where you read something and it's just really clicking for you. Well, Legion's really clicking for me right now.
Yeah, I took a break at one point from comics or buying new comics because I was back in school, and so there's some stuff from DC that I missed, and I've gone back and read some of it, but when Jeff Johns was writing the storylines in like Action Comics and stuff, and sort of made like the Legion history with all the reboots and stuff into like one storyline.
Yeah, the Legion of Three Worlds. So
yeah,
it was great.
Like I've gone back and I've read like Final Crisis by itself, but like that Final Crisis era, there's a number of things that I haven't read, I haven't read that stuff, and I haven't read you know the new Levitz Legion that came out of it. But I did read the Legion Secret Origin miniseries in the New 52, which I thought that was good. And obviously I've heard that they are canceling it, and I just feel like they fucked Legion. It's like a missed opportunity. Like, I think that they could have.
I think Legion is intimidating, and I think that their relaunch, they effed it up. They effed it up because they could have gotten everybody to at least try that first issue, and they effed it up that way. Because people were buying, like, in other words, I want to try all the – they're relaunching the line. I'm going to buy every New 52. And then they had all those discounts where try every one of them. And there was really nothing there to, like, initially suck you into either of those books and say, man, I got to get onto this. I have to. And
exactly.
It was a missed opportunity because Legion's always suffered from, where do I start? Where do I go on? Fuck it. Just don't fall into that shit. Just pick up a book and just start. You will figure out. You're smart enough. You will figure out what's going on.
But I remember, like, I listened to so many different podcasts because I was just seeking out as many podcasts covering the number ones that, as I could find.
Yeah.
At that time, just to hear everybody's reactions to the new 52. And because of the way that they did it, you know, like you said, so many people were like, I'm going to read every single number one and then I'm going to see what I think. And like across the board, you know, people were just trashing Legion of Superheroes number one because they're just like, you know, what the hell is this? Like, this is not a number one issue. And, you know, I remember reading interviews where they pretty much said, yeah, you know, we're not really, you know, rebooting Legion of Superheroes. We're just continuing on from the old.
That was a mistake.
It's like
because everybody that has trouble with the X-Men, it's the same reason. The Legion's like overwhelming because there's like so many freaking characters. But if you could build on it and have people join you at the beginning, then you might get new readers. But
yeah,
what you ended up maintaining is the readers that were reading you all along, which is roughly 16,000 people.
Right. Like, I can understand. Like, they're like, okay, we're going to keep most of the continuity of Batman and Green Lantern because those are our best sellers. And obviously, we're doing something right there. I mean, like, I can understand the thought process behind that. But I don't understand, like, when you have a book that's not selling well, you know, why continue? You know, it doesn't make sense. It didn't make sense for the Legion to do that. I don't think it's as intimidating as most people think.
I'm not intimidated by anything. Because I found I even picked up the Star Slayer. I didn't start with number one. I freaking jumped on number 19. I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Right.
As a comic reader, at least the seasoned one, that you at least can follow threads and stuff and then start to put two and two together and you'll figure out what's going on.
Yeah. But that said, I mean, it's not even the fact that it is Legion and that it has a reputation for being hard to get into. It's the fact that it was a number one issue and it was rebooting a property that wasn't selling well, you know. And yeah. I don't think a number one issue should like hand everything to you, but there is a good, you know, there is a good way to write number one issue, and
there's a wrong way to do it. And
yeah.
Uber number zero is a perfect way that lost me, and then I got sucked in with number one. Like if I had my philosophy where I was like, read an issue and then jump off, I would have jumped off so many freaking books.
Mm-hmm.
And then I find out I love the fucking things because I kept with it.
Yeah. And a lot of people aren't willing to give the benefit of the doubt. I mean, people were buying the new 52 and they were making a special allowance in their budget to try every number one. But they, you know, most people were, you know, knew from the outset, I'm not going to keep buying every series. And
yeah, they were making hard decisions. In other words, yeah. I can only buy 10, but this one month I'm going to buy all 52 and find out what I want to buy or something like that.
Yeah, and it wasn't a hard decision for a lot of people to cut Legion of Superheroes, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people want an opportunity to get in on ground, on the ground level with Legion. And I think there was a lot of people that wanted Legion of Superheroes to be one of the books that they bought.
Mm-hmm.
And DC didn't give them that opportunity that they thought they were going to get with a no number one. And then it made it all the more frustrating that like a month or two later, they offer this Legion Superheroes, I mean, Legion Secret Origin miniseries that was perfect for that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if that had been the first six issues of the actual series, it would have been what people wanted because that was really good actually, you know?
Right. Yeah, I could have talked. The other thing that was cool in this book is I also learned that Supergirl, like I know Supergirl was a big part of Legion and Wade's run, right? Because it was even called Supergirl in the Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah.
But she was part of the Legion way back when, and I didn't realize that. I knew Superboy was. I didn't know Supergirl was, because she comes with Superboy in this issue to fight Darkseid. And it's cool seeing... Maybe it's because I know enough about Legion. Like, I say I'm weak in it, but I've been reading it for freaking 10 years. But maybe it's because this is what I needed, I think, to connect a lot of dots and appreciate the property more, you know, or to get me excited for the property, because I'm huge on history, man. I just get excited. And like, even these Flash issues, I'm like, oh shit, this is Dr. Alchemy. What is he doing? But I get excited, and it's like little things in these books just trigger off my love for comics, and like, it's just so much history there.
Yeah.
Like Block. Like, I learned a lot about Block in the Legion. He got recruited in these issues that I read. He became a Legionnaire. So did Invisible Boy. It's also cool to see that a lot of people want to leave because of their relationships, like Bouncing Boy and Dual Damsel. They decided, let's get the hell out of here. This was the time when Dual Damsel lost her triplicate. Like she had lost it and was traumatized. Like, she didn't even want to go fight, help him out one time, because she was still getting over the fact that she lost one of her, I guess it's one of her, how would you say, one of her...
Like a third of herself.
A third of herself, yeah, there you go. So... Yeah, it bounce, and you'll see that with a lot of the Legionnaires, man. They'll get in these relationships and say, well, we want to go on an extended vacation, Mon-El and Shadowlass, so we're going to go on reserve status. And then they're like struggling with trying to get new recruits in. But my Block is not this Block, but they kind of built him into a powerful... I'm more of, before Legion, I was more of a Legion 89, 90, 91, you know, with that Legion, which was more like, what if Legion was happening now in the DCU?
Yeah.
I absolutely love that, and I can see it, and now I'm seeing all kinds of links with Threshold, you know, and like Stealth, and all kinds of cool shit. And yeah, I'm fortunate enough that I get to buy enough that I get to read a lot of shit.
Yeah, and it's nice when a talented writer can tie stuff back to history without requiring that you read it or know it, you know. But if you do go back and read the old stuff, you see those links and you can get an even deeper appreciation, you know.
Yeah.
It's nice when they can get that balance right, that like, if someone just wants to read new stuff and don't want to go back, they can still understand everything. But for those of us who want to go back and see that stuff, it makes it even cooler, you know, even deeper.
Right.
That's always really nice. But yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that I can get into the Legion, is I've always liked team books that have a shifting cast. Ever since I was a kid, it's just always fascinated me. You know, when I would get Avengers comics, and I was always a big fan of the team, you know, the team changing issues when they had a new assemble. And just to see like all the potential recruits and who leaves the team. I mean, I love when I read a team book, I like for members to come and go. I always find it fascinating, like, okay, this person's leaving the team and why they're leaving, and now this person's going to join. And I like there to be a shifting lineup, you know?
Right.
And the Legion is just, it's like a smorgasbord of that.
Yeah.
You know, because there's so many characters.
The other thing that I thought Wade introduced, but he didn't, was the relationship between Supergirl and Brainiac 5. That was already happening in this book, but it was referencing the past. In other words, we used to have a thing, and now we don't. So I'm like, wow, that's interesting. You know how history kind of repeats itself.
Yeah, everything kind of goes in cycles. It's funny how when you go back, it's another thing sometimes you realize, you know, something that you read when you were young that blew you away, you go back even further and you realize, like, what they were inspired by, and then, you know, it's just like everything is inspired by something that came before it, you know?
Yeah. I will say, if you're in the right mindset to absorb what you're reading, even if it's a golden age or a silver age, if you're in the right, you will love it. I mean, it's just, you have mm-hmm. to be in the right intake.
Yeah.
But
yeah, if you know enough about comics, you can kind of guide yourself to the right stuff for the mood that you're in, you know?
That's why answering questions like, where should I start? It's such a hard thing for me personally to answer, because, yeah, I can make recommendations, but I almost want to just say, jump the hell in. Just jump in. You'll find it what you like. But I also can't give recommendations to somebody I know nothing about. Like, you need to say, what kind of TV do you like? What kind of sci-fi do you like? Do you like horror? What do you like? And then I can recommend something. But,
you need to know a little bit more about the person than just, you know, what should I read?
Because I watch everything. So asking me is like asking the wrong person. Well, we have a few questions. Not a lot, but we have a few.
Okay.
So I thought we could dig into those. Donnie says, first comic ever read or favorite series as a kid? I think we answered the first comic I ever read, but it was like, I think it was Archie or something. I can't even remember, because my dad used to take me to the dump, and we used to just get comics, and they didn't have any covers, so you didn't even know what the freaking title was. I would just read comics. I don't know exactly what the first one is, but it was probably Archie or Superman. And my favorite series as a kid, I would say Flash, and that's why he's one of my favorite characters. I started in the 20-cent days, and in the 20-cent day that I started, it would always have a cool rogue on the cover, which the covers would always suck me in, because you'd have a rogue fighting the Flash, and to me, he has the best rogue gallery than anybody, but that's me. Him and Batman are tops. And then the other thing that sucked me in is I got 2-for-1. Back then, they had Green Lantern didn't have his own book. So if you wanted to read Green Lantern, you'd read Flash, because he'd be in the backup feature. And that was the series that I would try to find. But back in the day, I didn't always have money. When I did have money, I would try to go buy comics, but I wasn't guaranteed to follow it issue by issue, but I would follow at least I every other month or every third month I try to get an issue of Flash. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I don't know for sure. I know that I think I've said that the first comics I read were packs of Marvel comics that my parents bought for me that were like 3-packs or whatever. And so going back and looking at databases and things, I think that my first comic might have been an Avengers. I know some of my first comics were, in the late 80s, were Marvel comics that had the month where they had a lot of the issues had the border that would be like a character portrait of like Thor or Cyclops or whoever. If it was a team book, they just picked one of the characters. And then around the portrait had a border of little Marvel characters like all around. So I'm pretty sure it was one of those. I think I've gone back and read a couple of them for the show.
Yeah, it was like one of our first shows.
Yeah.
Because I remember one of those that had that border. It had the Black Knight in the middle.
Yeah, and that was Avengers storyline with the Masters of Evil.
Yeah.
Taking over Avengers Mansion. And then the Thor one was a tie-in to the Fall of the Mutants, where he goes down into the sewers and finds Angel pinned to the wall by his wings. But for me, Amazing Spider-Man, when I started reading, that was the end of the McFarlane run, and when Eric Larson took over as artist. That was one of the only comics I ever had a subscription to. So I remember getting issues of the Eric Larson's Amazing Spider-Man in the mail.
It was a good run.
Yeah, I still like his art.
I always think of his run as there was that one character that was that doctor that had a pole. I can't remember what his name was, like Cardiac or.
Oh yeah.
Do you remember that guy?
Yeah.
Every time I see him, I think of Eric Larson. I don't know why. It seemed like he showed up a lot.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that dude. Yeah, yeah. There was some interesting like. There's certain I kind of associate with him for no real reason, but with Prowler, because they don't really have an association. I just found it. They were like obscure characters that I was really curious about when I was young, because they weren't your like iconic Marvel superheroes that you saw all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, well, who are these guys? Where did they come from?
Yeah.
And I think it's because of the Avengers books I read when I was a kid, where I got like the fascination with like B-list characters and mm-hmm. strange villains and stuff.
And Alan asks, are you going to Baltimore Con?
Oh, I'm hoping to. Did you get your ticket yet? When do you usually...
No, I'll probably buy it this month. I bought my ticket for Heroes, which is next month.
Yeah.
Just recently.
Yeah, I'd like to...
I did miss out, though. I think I'm going to buy my ticket this month just because I don't want to risk any... Like for the Denver one, I missed the Rock Comic Con thing because you have to buy a separate ticket for that. So I'm not going to get to see Kirby Crackle this year, which sucks. But I did get the 3-day pass. So.
Cool.
The month of – what are we in now? The month of June? The month of June is going to be rough for me to record because it seems like I'm at a Comic Con every week.
Yeah, I remember you saying that you had a bunch in a row.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of traveling, but...
Heroes and then...
Heroes, Albuquerque, and Denver, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it should be fun and eventful. William Purcell said, your podcast has inspired me to read Silver Age Marvel Comics by year. I started with 1961, and I'm starting the year 1966. I noticed a lot of series started by Jack Kirby and taken over by artists drawing in the Jack Kirby style. The drawings are very Kirby-esque, and unless you look at the credits, you can't tell. My question is, what do you think of Kirby impersonators? I love them because they impersonate somebody I love. Tom Scholey, I don't even know if I call him an impersonator. I think
no.
He bases his work... on something that he loved, and mm-hmm. it's close to his style, but it's still his own style. So I still consider all the, I guess the Kirby impersonators having their own styles. They look mm-hmm. similar, and Kirby's had many styles. So it's like there's some Kirby books that I almost freak out that he's drawn, especially like his Golden Age stuff. His Golden Age style doesn't look anything like his 70s Bronze Age style. Because my Kirby is the 78, you know, Bronze Age style, which is kind of what we're covering on this show.
Right.
But even if you go to early Fantastic Four, it didn't start to develop into the Kirby that was the 7, you know, until later. It kind of looked really different.
He's not as defined.
Yeah, and then he did Romance Comics, and it mm-hmm. looked different, and it depends on who's inking him, and... I think the more control he had, the more his style came out. That's what I think. But
yeah, I think there's like two different kinds. You have, you know, people who like Keith Giffen's work on Olmec and stuff, where because of the property and you know his love for Kirby, he intentionally changes his style to evoke Kirby, and they, you know, you have like Tom Scioli who, you know, isn't afraid for people to know that he's influenced by him.
Yeah.
But then you also had, I mean, I think in the case of the era that he's talking about, I think you had, I haven't read a lot of them myself, but I think you had a lot of, you know, Stan Lee, like Marvel editorial and stuff saying, you know, like maintain the style. But you also had, I mean, when Kirby was at Marvel the first time, you know, they, even when he was there, they wanted artists to draw like him, and they wanted them, you know, artists would come in and they would be trained by him, and he would push them to draw faster and to get more, you know, because they were, you know, Marvel were used to Kirby's level of output, and
nobody can do that.
Nobody could do it, but he would like.
They didn't realize he was a mutant. His his God given mutant power was to draw comics.
Yeah. But if he could get them at least to go a little faster, and, you know, so you had a lot of artists that were trained by Kirby to draw like Kirby, and that's what, you know, Marvel wanted. So, you know, I think so. You have like two different kinds. Like, you have people that were trained and told to imitate him, and then you have people who are inspired by him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I know I liked, in modern times, I mean, I liked Giffen's work on OMAC a lot. I guess it all depends on how good they are at aping the style. And, you know, as far as the 60s stuff goes, I haven't really looked at it much myself. But if they do a good job, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. I got nothing against it. If I could draw, I'd draw like Kirby, just because I'd get so much pleasure drawing all the time. Stare at my own artwork. The other questions are kind of like, will you podcast cover some Steve Ditko, John Romita? This is from Donnie Ann William. Ditko, John Romita Sr., or Kubert? I'm sure we will.
Yeah.
I don't think we have to date, but
only, yeah, if at all.
If at all, I might have done a Kubert, but for my war comics I was talking about. But
I think Kurt Kubert's come up, and he's done, because he's done a cover here or there or something on something.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, naturally, you know, none of those guys have... Well, we haven't covered anybody like we've covered Kirby, but but it would be cool to take a look at some other really, you know, iconic artists like those mentioned, you know.
Yeah, I can dig into Steve Ditko. I have an omnibus of at least his DC work I'd like to get into. The other book that I want to get into, I don't know if you have it, but I know Chuck, one of our listeners, Chuck Lordens, goes by Savage Chuck, wants to come on the show and talk about Doom Patrol, if you've got any Doom Patrol.
I don't, but I would be willing to pick it up, because I like Doom Patrol, I mean.
Yeah, I wanted to pop up the archive and start at the beginning, because... Either that or the showcase. I think Doom Patrol is showcased. I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah, probably.
But I think for the most part, yeah, I want to cover some Ditko. I don't know much about Romita Sr., but because of his link to Marvel, I didn't read a lot of Marvel then. And Kubert, I've read a lot of, but. I don't have a lot of like collections of him.
I haven't read much Kubert, but you know, I've gone back, and I don't know what happened to him, but I used to have a lot of the Amazing Spider-Man, you know, showcases. Marvel doesn't call them showcases. I forget what they call them. Essentials or something.
Marvel Masterworks.
No, but I mean, like, showcases are the, like, black and white reprints.
Oh, Essentials.
Yeah, Essentials. I read through all the early, like, all the Ditko and I read a whole lot of the Spider-Man ones because, like I said, I grew up reading Spider-Man. I was interested in going back and reading all the early Amazing Spider-Mans. But that was a while ago. I think it was over 10 years ago, I think, that I read those.
Yeah.
But, I like Ditko. I think Ditko was a... As much as I like Kirby, I think it's awesome that Ditko was chosen to write those early Spider-Man issues, because I think I really like the combination of his style with, early Peter Parker.
And Doctor Strange.
Yeah, he's a good choice for that, too. His style is a really good combination with those stories.
Yeah, I think next month they're soliciting another artist I want to read. I can't remember if I saw it on Newsarama, but Marvel's soliciting a Steranko S.H.I.E.L.D. Release, which that's one of the things I want to read.
I saw they were solicited that.
I'm kind of excited to buy that.
Yeah, I became curious about that from reading Marvel The Untold Story.
Mm-hmm.
That was reading that made me interested in a lot of like 70s Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
When Starlin and those guys were there, and they were like, they spent half their day writing comics and the other half like wandering around New York City tripped out on LSD. Like, they would seriously, like, drop acid and just, like, wander around the city, and then they'd, like, have these, like, visions that they would put into their comics. Pretty crazy.
Like Steranko?
I don't know if Steranko was one. I'm trying to remember. I'm not exactly who was.
I couldn't picture Kirby doing that just because of his output.
No.
His imagination, maybe.
Yeah, he didn't need it, yeah. No, it was, like, they were all, at the time, like, young recruits to Marvel. This is when Starlin was, probably in his 20s and stuff.
Hmm.
But.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to do a Ditko week. I don't know if we have anything that we could read together, but we could maybe pick some Ditko property and then read it,
Yeah, I'd be down for that.
All right, I think that's it for the questions. Okay. One more question: did Chris ever roll a six? I don't know if that references, but
I know what it references. Okay. I can't remember what each number, what a particular number indicates. I couldn't quite follow.
the chaos
as far as like what number means what. I know what
kept changing.
Yeah, I know what some other range is. That's true.
Two is sit on my face.
No, but it's funny to me because I've also played some D&D back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it pretty amusing.
I thought it would be an interesting episode, and when I posted something like, because I had emails from this episode, like people like, oh, that was the funniest shit ever, and like all kinds of different stuff, but they weren't really D&D fans, so I posted something and actual people replied saying, when are you going to play D&D? I want in on this.
Oh yeah, I saw that, yeah.
There are like three people that wanted to play D&D, so Keith could, build a list of people to play with.
Yeah, I actually just put in this little box I have underneath the futon here, and I got my dice, dice tube in here. I got the D20, D12.
We didn't get up to those numbers yet.
Yeah, I think it sounds like you were just rolling 6,000 dice. Here, I got one here. Let me see what I get. I rolled a 3. I have to ask Daryl what a 3 is.
Yeah, Keith is funny in that episode because he was just getting mad.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, actually, that was what was making me laugh the most, probably, is that he Like, it wouldn't have been as funny if he was going along with it. It's like,
he's just disgusted. Poor guy. Yeah. He loves D&D so much.
Yeah. I mean,
he obviously loves it if he turned down sex for D&D, so.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, when I played, I was in middle school or something. I think I was already at a point that I would have ran towards sex if I just didn't have the option.
Yeah, Daryl's online. I'm going to skate. What does a 3 mean? What does a 3 mean when you roll?
Chris rolled a 3. What does he have to do?
All right, so we got some the last Flash Showcase issue to talk about, and a couple issues of Flash, which continued from the Golden Age Flash in numbering.
Yeah.
105, 106. So issue 14, also, what is it, Carmen Infantino, and who did the writing on that?
The first story is Robert Kaniger, and the second is John Broom.
That's very interesting. Robert Kaniger, I know for his war stories, but he's done a lot of stories.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it really interesting that every issue, sometimes you get a 16-page issue, a 12-page issue. I mean, you get two comics in every issue.
Yeah. And
I guess they vary the size of the pages based on the story they have to tell. But no matter what they tell, with the exception of one of these issues, he's always got a date with Iris.
Yeah.
Usually always late.
Yeah. To the point that, yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. Like, I almost just expect it and read past it. I don't really pay attention to it. It's like, yeah, they have another date. I expect that. But I do like that it, like, gets worse and worse, where as we get into these issues, she's, like, she starts talking about how the Flash is a real man.
Yeah.
And he's, like, compared to him. But it's really, that's, like, totally the Clark Kent Superman thing with Lois Lane, you know? And that's been done with them too, where she's like, you know, admiring Superman while he's sitting across the table from her in his civilian identity.
Yeah, it almost makes it feel like this is a date out of I don't know, like we have to do this, like we have to have lunch and we have to have dinner, but she doesn't seem to enjoy all his company that much. Mm-hmm. Like she's more frustrated with him. Like,
yeah.
He's so slow. Why can't he be more like the Flash?
Right. Yeah, they do.
And Barry's always wondering, well, if she only knew I was the Flash.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a little like I would be looking forward to seeing when they get to a point where Iris has a little bit more depth of character, you know? But, like, at this point, it's not something that they've really developed.
Well, they make it look like she's flying a freaking plane.
Although that, well, yeah, once we get to the actual, like, this first story is probably this would be the most Golden Age seeming. It's a little, the story's ridiculous.
She goes on to a plane. It's like an experimental plane, I guess, to report on it.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets, like, is she flying the plane or is she just on the plane?
You know, I was looking at the panels for a while, asking myself that same question. I think she's flying the plane because the close-up of her face in the bottom left-hand corner, she's holding
the gear shift, the flight stick.
So, yeah.
So she can fly a plane, but yet...
And I like that she makes a point of explaining that she's not going up in the plane to take a picture of the new rocket.
Yeah.
But to take pictures of the city at sunset.
Right. And so she's not only a good... She can not only fly a plane, but she's like Tom Cruise in Top Gun. She could fly a plane at top speeds and snap pictures.
Right. And the only reason I like that, the only reason she mentions the new rocket is because it's a plot point later, you know. Otherwise, it's like not a real reason. And all of a sudden, Barry has a TV phone. Or, I mean, a TV watch, so he can communicate with Iris with his watch. So I don't think we've seen that before.
Yeah, he's got a fancy watch.
Yeah. But, yeah, in the Flash...
We don't even have that kind of technology right now.
No. Or we're like, we've just gotten there.
Yeah.
But it's no thing, you know. He's got the hookup with the as being a police scientist, I guess.
Maybe through a cell phone we have that technology, but not through a watch. Yeah. At least I've never seen it.
But Barry remembers that Iris mentioned the rocket launch, so he... He runs up the side of the rocket as it's taking off and rides it like Dr. Strangelove, riding the bomb.
Yeah, that was kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
He rides a rocket, and then he starts to run into to go back into time and ends up in Lilliput.
Yeah, he breaks the time barrier, and then he ends up tied down like Gulliver. But the Lilliputians... in this case, they're little green Martian men who actually have the ability to grow up into giants. And they start stomping around, trying to step on them.
Well, it seems like with each second they get bigger.
Yeah.
Until they die, I guess. But whatever their agenda is, they want to destroy Earth.
Or I think actually, like, it's time. It's a timed growth, so they shrink back down to normal size again.
Oh, okay.
For a while, yeah. At the end there, but this was a sillier issue than or sillier story than some of the ones we've had so far, and the rest of the ones we're going to talk about. It's like I said, it's early Silver Age, so you have some aspects of these stories that still feel like Golden Age tropes.
That's probably my least favorite issue of this trade anyway.
Yeah, but the second story of Showcase is pretty good.
I did like the idea that these guys are growing every second. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a pretty cool concept. But the fact that Flash could just hit these time barriers is kind of weird, you know. It almost makes him invulnerable. If things didn't work out, I'll just run back in time.
Yeah, that's been a aspect of the Flash that writers have been dealing with for really since the Silver Age, trying to like balance that his power level and. But yeah, we do get the ending where Barry's rescuing Iris and she asks him to have a talk with her boyfriend Barry Allen, since he's a sweet guy, but he's slower than a turtle with lumbago, back pain, and he's like, maybe you could tell him to speed up a little. And Flash says that it sounds like it'd be impossible.
It seems like he'd be able to do his identity pretty easy because he's so fast. Oh, I'm Barry. I'm the Flash. I'm Barry. I'm the Flash. I'm Barry.
Yeah.
He can have a conversation with himself. But, yeah, like you said, this next issue I found really entertaining. This Dr. Alchemy is awesome because he's really Mr. Element. He just changed his idea. Last episode we talked about Mr. Element going to jail after he launched him into space. But Mr. Element, he's pretty badass, but he has, like, he could, like, do so much if he would, like, if he wanted to become rich, he could become rich without even messing with the Flash, but he's got an obsession with the Flash. Mm-hmm. He wants to take out the Flash, and that's his downfall.
Yeah. I do like the fact that, you know, we've had, in comics, you always have, you know, characters taking on new identities, especially villains that are, like, sort of B-list villains that are, maybe trying something new, and not necessarily that Dr. Alchemy is, but I like that, you know, he had this shtick, he's going to be Mr. Element, and then the fact that he's changing to Dr. Alchemy, I like that it's connected to the fact that alchemy is all about change anyway, so in some ways it, like, fits the theme for him to change his identity, you know?
Yeah, yeah,
it does. I kind of like that.
I like the fact that he met this guy, Ben Snipper, in jail, mm-hmm. and he tells him about his lucky stone, and when he gets out of jail, he breaks out. That's the first thing he goes and gets, and that stone turns out to be the Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah, and turns out it works like a television remote. It's like holds it and presses different spots on it to change things.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you posted on Facebook about it, like his methodology is a little wacky because he's, like you said, he's so obsessed with the Flash that, you know, he turns some garbage cans to gold so that he can rob a bank on the other side of town. He just could have kept, like, the gold garbage cans, but, you know, he uses those as a distraction.
He probably could have made, he probably had more money in gold than he robbed. That's what I don't understand.
Mm-hmm. And he's just kind of like drawing the Flash in.
Doesn't he turn like the coins into liquid metal too and gets away? Like he slips.
Mm-hmm.
Makes Flash slip.
Into mercury, actually.
And I thought it was kind of funny how they have this one scene where he said, "It's rush hour, I'm going to lose him in a crowd." And he's the only one that's like dressed. Everybody's dressed normally. He's the only one in a hood, a green hood. It's like,
oh,
you
can't
see him. He's right there.
Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of funny that Flash is slipping around on mercury, which the other name for is Quicksilver.
Yeah.
Another speedster. But yeah.
Two speedsters, Mercury and Quicksilver.
Oh, true, yeah. I guess this might have. I wonder if this was before they knew about mercury poisoning, because Flash doesn't seem too worried about that.
No, he doesn't. He touches it with his boots.
That's true. But yeah, like it seems like it's every episode. Or it seems like an episode. Every story ends up with Barry and Iris having dinner or lunch, like you said.
Yeah. But he does make a, like, he turns this cave into like glass crystal, and he has to break it, and then he turns the air into rubber, and Flash has to break out of that, and then eventually he captures the Dr. Alchemy and puts him back in prison.
Yeah, and he throws the Philosopher's Stone
into space.
Into space at 25,000 miles per hour, and there's a little editor's note that says, "Any object moving 25,000 miles per hour or faster will escape from the Earth's gravitational field and never return." I do like that. There's, you know, these like precursor of like Flash facts, you know, like and like I said last time, you know, I appreciate the fact that it's, you have these scientific facts, and that, you know, Barry is a police scientist. I like that mm-hmm. that connects there.
And that leads us into Flash 105, which is one of my favorite Flash villains, mm-hmm. Mirror Master. And very interesting for me, because I never knew his origin, at least this Mirror Master's origin. Which right, I believe this is the one that died.
Original.
Yeah, Sam the original. Scudder. Yeah. But it doesn't open with that story. This is interesting. It's like, if you have Mirror Master on the cover, he'll be the second story. If you have Pied Piper on the cover, he'll be the second story. The mm-hmm. first story has Cotmos, Conqueror from 8 million BC. And that's interesting, because you have an archaeologist walking around Central Park, and he's just walking around, and he gets this urge. He's like, "Why do I have this urge to dig in a certain location?" And he's like being summoned by Catmos, mm-hmm. and Catmos is used, like, he can take over people's brains, and he has him dig him out and free him and release him. And now Katmos is saying, I'm going to conquer this period of time. He basically went out with the dinosaurs, so when the asteroids and the climates changed, he kind of froze himself in suspended animation, and now he wants to be free, take over the world again.
Yeah. Yeah, we get Barry, for the first time, recounting his origin, like if people... They're just jumping on, you know, since this is the first issue that of actually is ongoing, even though they're, you know, they're continuing the numbering from the, which is always interesting because it's just so much different than today, you know.
I mean, Keith Knutson would have never read The Flash because it started off with 105.
He's like, I'm not going to go back reading 104 Golden Age
I'm not
going
to go back.
The Keith Knutson of 1959 was just like, no thanks.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just so, but it's such a different philosophy from today because they wanted like people to look and see, oh, 105, this is a successful comic. I should read this.
Right.
It's been around for a long time. It must be good. but yeah, I like, so that we get a little recount of the origin is, you know, Barry's working in his office and he's just remembering what happened. And, but I like, Katmos. I think my favorite part of the story was that Katmos has this, mind controller gun and he expects it to make people into slaves. But for some reason it's working the opposite. So he blasts this dude sitting on a bench reading a book about relativity.
That was my favorite part of the book too. That's fucking awesome.
He's like, oh, shit, I suddenly understand Einstein's theory. I know all about atomic power. I've become a genius. So he's just like he's zapping people and just making them into brilliant geniuses.
Yeah, he's like, I can't allow that to happen. Yeah. He thinks shit. So he's like, oops.
Yeah.
Gotta recalibrate this gun.
Yeah. I put it in the wrong setting. Shit.
I made him smarter. I love that. That was like an oh shit moment.
Yeah, that was like one of the best screw-ups.
And they don't ever show that guy again, but we have a genius. Like, they might show him in another issue.
If they don't, man, that would be like the awesomest thing ever if you had this guy show up as a supervillain in like 2013. And he's just like, you know, he's just super, super smart because he got blasted by Katmos.
Hell yeah. I would take him if nobody else did.
Yeah.
I mean, if we might read something down the line where he does become a villain or a good guy or whatever, but...
Well, he's not even, like, named, you know?
No.
So I'd be surprised.
If I was writing him, I'd put him in right now. Yeah. Right into a Flash story. This guy's a genius. How did he become a genius? Well, Katmos blasted him with a ray gun.
They have like a flashback to the scene. So everybody can, you know, see Flash 105.
Well, you couldn't do that in the New 52. You'd have to have a new guy on a park bench.
Yeah. It could be like this dude's son. He's like a big failure because his dad was such a genius and like he couldn't live up to his dad's expectations. So he's like super depressed and like suicidal, and then all of a sudden like he gets blasted by a new Katmos and he's a genius as well. He hates his father even though he's finally living up to his dad's expectations.
It's funny when you said my favorite part of the book because I knew what you were going to say. I was like, that was awesome.
But yeah, Katmos kind of looks like a bulimic Silver Surfer.
Yeah.
With green underpants.
And he's based on iron instead of carbon-based life form.
That was cool. I thought that was kind of a cool idea.
Yeah.
But I don't wonder. I guess he has a like a silver schlong or something. Because I don't know why he would wear green underpants.
He's got a holster, so
I guess he needs some
to hold
he needs underwear to connect to his holster to keep his gun.
Comics approved. You couldn't have anybody with genitalia.
Yeah, he would have to be like a, you know, like a doll with no privates.
Yeah.
So.
But he captures the Flash and puts him in this green encasing, which when the sun hits it, is supposed to make him heavier, and as time goes on until he hits 100 tons, and he'll never be able to move again. But Flash decides to run around in a steady pace or really fast inside of the... I thought he was going to bury underneath it like by doing that, but he actually launched himself into the atmosphere and crashed the cylinder and became free. And then Catmos couldn't get his gun straight, couldn't shoot it again because he's moving so fast, and they defeat him, and I guess they put him in a prison.
Yeah.
And he makes dinner on time.
He's a prehistoric thief.
They're either going to dinner or lunch every episode, every issue. They should just get married already. Well, they are engaged, I think.
Uh-huh.
He mentions fiancé later.
And Barry's always... I wonder if she wonders why he's always so freaking hungry. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's funny that it kind of sucks for the Flash that, you know, anytime a supervillain happens to attack, it's always on a day that they have a date. It must be like weekend, you know, weekend supervillains are active on the weekends. Nobody, you know, decides to attack on like a Tuesday.
Yeah.
When he was just going to like go home and, you know, chill at his apartment by himself. But the second story was pretty awesome because, like you said, I mean, I, you know, I just kind of, I don't really know this Mirror Master. I know, you know, the second one.
Mm-hmm. Isn't his name Scudder or something like that? I can't remember.
Scudder's the first one.
Oh.
This is Sam Scudder, and then the second one is Scottish. He was, you know, he was introduced actually in Animal Man by Grant Morrison.
He's more of an asshole, and he does cocaine.
Yeah,
he does. He likes to do drugs, but this one's interesting because this guy started off in prison, like he didn't start off as a bad guy, and then. He was already in prison making mirrors. I guess prisons made mirrors back in the day.
Yeah, he was already... It wasn't his new powers that, you know, decided... You know, made him decide to go into a life of crime. It was... He was already a villain. Or not already, but he was already a crook. And then got powers. Evan McCulloch is the second one. It's the second Mirror Master. But so his powers are a little bit different than the second Mirror Master's, the ones that I'm used to. He can capture somebody's image in a mirror, and then he develops, you know, for a simple convict, he's pretty smart guy. He develops a machine that he can put these mirrors into, and then it creates a life-size mirror image that he can then control to do his bidding. You know, so he does that of a guy that works at the local bank, or and sends him there to rob the bank, or to, you know, to use his identity, and Barry happens to be there because he's got to make he's got to cash a check before he meets Iris for lunch.
But he's smart. He like sees him walk by, and he notices that his part is on the other side. His ring is on the other side of his, you you know, so like a mirror image of the character. So he knows something's not up and starts to follow him. And when he starts to follow him, he's like, I can't keep up with him. Why the hell's going on?
Yeah, the guy's he's moving normal when he's inside the bank, but as soon as he leaves the bank, he just like takes off at a ridiculous speed so fast that the Flash is having trouble keeping up with him. And it's only because as he's about to lose sight of him, he disappears into, and there's only one house nearby, so the Flash assumes that that's where he disappeared. And Mirror Master sees Flash show up, so he kind of leads him on a chase around the house. Flash ends up in a room with a bunch of mirrors, so he can't really tell which one's the bank teller that he was following. But conveniently, there's a can of black paint.
Black.
Which I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Like, this is a pretty decrepit looking house, so I guess maybe they were in the process of renovations before, you know.
Have a black paint?
Took the place, but I don't know. I've done some painting, and
do you have black paint in your house? I mean, you have room where you paint things black?
No, I painted a wall black in somebody's house one time, just one wall. I tell you, it's a pain in the ass. So I don't know what these people were up to, but we had to put like.
Is it because so many you have to use so many coats to get it right, or what?
To get it actually, red is the next worst. It's something about the type of pigment that it is, and the darkness of it. It's just like you just have to do so many coats. It's ridiculous. So So. But I don't know what these people were doing, but it works out well for the Flash because he's able to use a process of elimination by blacking out the mirrors and find the real bank teller. But it's all for naught because the teller disappears and a giant mosquito, very cartoonish looking mosquito. Although I guess I don't know what they look like magnified to gigantic size.
I don't think they're green and orange.
But those eyes are, it's like these big red eyes are pretty crazy.
Yeah. And they have antenna that look like some kind of branch.
Yeah, they look like tree branches.
Tree branches or something. But he actually runs at the speed of light and just shatters the illusion or the effect. Mm-hmm. And that's when he realizes, hey, something ain't right here. And then he runs down, he goes through the bottom of the basement by, you know, turning around and around like Wonder Woman. And he ends up in the basement. Yeah. And there's a minotaur. And they tell us an editor's note. In Greek mythology, the minotaur was a half bull and half man. Well, you could kind of see that. but we have an editor's note for that. And true. He kind of does the, you know, the Bugs Bunny and bull scene here where he gets the red. There's a tablecloth that happens to be red. And he's like, Toro, Toro. Like,
yeah, if we get Flash playing the matador there.
But the bull is getting faster and faster and closer and almost piercing him. And that's when he realizes, maybe if I shut the lights off. He shuts the lights off and then the images are not reflecting anymore and then captures the Mirror Master and goes on a date. He's at dinner.
Yeah, I'm actually at this point I'm kind of curious. Like, it's going to be an occasion when there's a Flash story that doesn't end with them eating out.
Well, there is one in the next issue.
Oh, is there? Okay.
Because he does end up eating with somebody, but it's not Iris.
Oh, yeah.
It's a guy, it's an actor that dressed like an ape.
Right. And there's a point where she actually says that she's going to be late for a change. So they are starting to change it up a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is Flash issue 106. And as you mentioned, we have the first appearance of Pied Piper. And that's who's on the cover. So, but we also have a cover-worthy first appearance in the first story. So this is a pretty awesome issue for Flash fans. Yeah,
you really get your money's worth in this one.
Yeah.
First appearance of Gorilla Grodd. Shit.
And again, I said this last time, I think, but I'm just impressed with, you know, when we talk about Carmine Infantino being kind of the motivation for doing this, you know, the character designs and the, you know, the Grodd and the monkeys, like the monkeys look has a little bit different, but I mean, it's like you got monkeys. I mean, but as far as like the human villains and stuff like that, just their looks and stuff, it's a testament to just how many different characters they created so quickly and so many concepts were established so early on. I'm impressed by that, going back and seeing that how many things that still exist, you know, have lasted the test of time to today,
mm-hmm.
were created back this early in the Flash's run, you know.
I think that's why his Rogues Gallery is considered so popular, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it seemed like if you were going to the newsstand at this time picking this up, you were getting like a major villain every time. It was like,
yeah,
and they lasted, you know, they're time tested a lot of these villains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty impressive. So yeah, as you mentioned, Barry's got an actor friend named Fred Pearson, and he's pretty distraught because he's been appearing in a play called The Great Gorilla as the Gorilla, and there's these reports of gorillas around town, and he thinks that he might be blacking out and perpetrating these crimes, so he calls his police scientist friend for advice.
The poor guy is an actor who's been dressing like a gorilla for 3 years.
Oh yeah, it does say third big year. Yeah.
That poor guy. That's got to be one hot suit.
Yeah. So
here's where I started to really, maybe it was because I'm paying more attention, where the facial structures started to look more like the Carmen Infantino that I was used to later on. Because he also has that chin thing.
Mm-hmm.
You see how he's drawing that line where that chin is?
Yep.
Like, the era that I really read Carmen Infantino in is when, like, he had Big Sur and the court scene. He was on trial for killing Reverse Flash. And this is starting to look a lot more like that style of art.
Yeah, it's, as we've read through this volume, even though, you know, it's only 6 issues, I mean, they're long issues, but you can see his style becoming more refined as you go throughout.
Yeah.
Out on the street, Flash runs into this ship that's going at high speed. He can't even really tell that it's a ship until he starts running alongside it, and he's able to start to see some definition, because at first it's moving too fast to even understand what it is. It's just like it's traveling faster than a tornado. It reverses direction at the last seconds, causing the Flash to stop and put ruts into the ground because of the friction of stopping so suddenly. This happens on the way to him meeting his actor buddy for lunch or dinner or whatever.
Yeah, so he loses it. He doesn't know what's going on at this point in time.
Yeah.
And then his actor buddy explains to him what's going on, and then inside of the Central Park, you see a gorilla coming out of that ship that Flash was chasing.
Mm-hmm.
And that gorilla turns out to be Gorilla Grodd, and he tells you a little bit about Gorilla City. And interesting enough, he goes by the circus that's there, and we get introduced to Solovar, which mm-hmm. is the head of Gorilla City. He finds him in a cage, and Solovar was captured by humans, and he's playing stupid, basically, at the circus because he doesn't want to reveal the location of Gorilla City, and Grodd steals his mind. He uses the his force of mind, and he gets Salivar's knowledge out of there.
Yeah, he's like, he uses telepathy to steal Salivar's ability to mentally control others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Salivar, you know, he's basically like, you know, they're like the good and evil. Like, he's like Grodd's good counterpart.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just first appearances of individual gorillas from Gorilla City, but just like, this is the beginning of, you know, a long-standing connection between the Flashes and Gorilla City, you know, just that the beginning of that relationship.
Right, because Salivar actually seeks out the Flash, and he sits there and talks to him, explains to him everything that's going on and what Flash needs to help him.
Yeah, because he's like, okay, now that I know Grodd's loose here, I got to stop playing like I'm a normal gorilla, and he just escapes easily. And Barry sees a gorilla climbing his apartment window, so he uses his speed to change it to his costume really fast. And but you know, Grodd stops him by speaking English to Barry's surprise. It explains the situation.
He actually trusts Flash so much that he reveals Gorilla City to him, and he takes Salivar to Gorilla City, where Grodd is already in power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's using his power to control all the other gorillas and stuff. And
and he shook out Salivar's force of mind just by doing a whirlwind underneath him.
yeah, that was...
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Why doesn't he feed Grodd like that today?
Yeah, probably because it's a little rather convenient. I felt like they were kind of, you know... I mean, I like the story a lot. That was kind of a quick resolution for me, but I really enjoyed seeing the first appearance of Gorilla Grodd and Salivar in Gorilla City, and seeing the beginning of... I like that... I guess I could see how Salivar, you know, he is intelligent and he is listening. I mean, people...
Oh, yeah, and the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, and, you know, I could see how he might hear of the Flash's reputation and seek him out for that reason, and... I don't know. I mean, I like, whether it's Barry or Wally, like, I like my Flash as kind of like the, you know, sort of like everyday kind of guy that is trustworthy and tries to do his best, you know, and makes mistakes once in a while and stuff. And so I like that he has that reputation, and that Grodd, or that Salivar seeks him out and trusts him with their secret. Now, you know, Barry's able to reassure his friend that, you know, that it wasn't actually him. And, you're right, we get a ending that's not dinner. It's, Iris is still there, but they're at the zoo. And Barry's thinking to himself, I don't know if that's a regular gorilla or one of, the gorillas from Gorilla City, so.
Yeah, so they're building on the relationship, because this is the first one that she didn't really whine.
Yeah.
About him being slow. She's just wondering, why are you taking me to the zoo?
Why the hell are we going to the zoo? We need to go to dinner.
And you need to be late. Stupid fairy.
This isn't how the issue ends. Haven't you read the previous ones? I know you like comics.
And then we get the Pied Piper. And this is a guy who could have succeeded. Because this is what's weird about this. I don't understand why a villain would like they're trying to figure out, like, okay, they broke into the jewelry store, like the cops are. Well, why didn't they take any of the money? Why didn't they take any jewelry? It's like he could have succeeded immediately in stealing a lot of money, but he wanted to defeat the Flash.
Mm-hmm.
So he was doing crimes half-ass, like without... Yeah. He was, like, setting them up so they can do it later.
Yeah, and he uses his flute to attract a gang of, you know, to build up a gang of thugs. And the guys that he gets aren't really the brightest fellas around. But, you know, I guess he's looking for guys that he can control. And he's explaining to them, you know, his powers and that he's a master of sound. And he's telling them, you know, like some facts about sound and how powerful it can be. And he's like, you know, maybe you've heard of sonic booms. And the one guy's like, I heard of that, I think. and he's talking about vibrations and all that stuff. So it's convenient for us, the reader, that his henchmen are so dumb that he can explain the stuff to him and also to us. But, yeah, Barry's on time this time, so he went for a date, so you know something's going to go wrong.
Yeah, he goes on a date and hears something on the radio, and he has to leave the date. So he leaves. It looks like they're in an apartment, right?
Yeah, he's at their apartment. He's actually cooking them dinner.
Yeah, and he just decides to leave at super speed because he just leaves her hanging because he hears about what's on the radio. The Pied Piper is at like a bank or something.
Yeah, he runs right out the window and down the side of the building. And you can see a word bubble coming out of her apartment window. Well, how do you like that? The one time that Barry keeps a date with me on time, he walks out on me.
Yeah.
So.
And the Pied Piper's waiting for him, like, across of a lake. And he uses the lake to, like, he can use sound to, like, make these huge waves. And one of those waves strikes him and knocks out the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets away.
Yep.
So now he goes to rob a jewelry store, and then he's able to create an earthquake with his pipe and his flute, and Flash falls into the ground. But when he easily races back up and then takes out the Pied Piper that easy.
Yeah, he whirls his arm around it. Super speed, creating like a windmill, and just like knocks the Pied Piper and all his henchmen on their ass. But I think it looks pretty funny because it just looks like a spinning arm with legs. You can kind of see his head behind his arm spinning.
Yeah.
I mean, it's drawn well for what it is. It's just like it's kind of a funny image because it looks just like this spinning arm with legs sticking out. But yeah, he just kind of he creates like a. It creates like a stream of air behind him, basically just carries the Piper and his gang along in the airstream behind him.
The interesting thing I'm seeing, though, is you get less pages of the character that's featured on the cover than you actually get of the front story.
Oh, yeah.
Did you notice that? Like, this is only 10.
No, not when I was reading it.
This was only 10 pages, and the same with the Mirror Master is that Crotos story was longer than the. It's weird. Because this was only a 10-page story, and half mm-hmm. of it, like, is cropped off because it has a Flash symbol. But he goes back to Iris's, and she's like, Barry, what happened to you? I just stepped out to get a paper. And she's happy. Because she's part of the news, so she's happy to see that the Pied Piper is arrested.
Yeah, and they take some liberties with timing here because it doesn't really make sense that, you know, she acts like he hasn't been gone that long, but like a paper's already been printed explaining his exploits of capturing the Pied Piper gang.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that doesn't really quite make sense, but... I guess they were wrapping things up, and they had to fit a half-page ad on the page, apparently. Because at least I'm pretty sure that that's when they have those Flash symbols taking up half the page. It's because they don't want to reformat the pages, and that was an ad there.
Yeah, or one of the they tended to put like a comic there sometimes, like a little funny comic or something.
Yeah, just something.
Sugar and Spike or something. Here you go. But that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm glad that I've had this for a little while. I'm glad I finally got around to reading it, like I said, and it was because I don't know, like they're keeping some of these in print, but it's like it looks like they sort of let them go out of print and then they reprint some of them. So I wanted to grab volumes 3 and 4, so I don't have to bother trying to track them down. I just
hope they keep going, but I know they'll stop at some point and say, well, you can go get issues for that.
yeah. It all depends, like, I guess on sales, you know. I mean, Batman Chronicles are already up to something in the teens, but, you know, that and Superman are starting in the golden age, so.
Yeah.
I think it's volume 3 that has the Flash of Two Worlds story in it, and volume 4 I think takes you into the 120s somewhere, but after that, I mean, the issues are still somewhat pricey, and I think, well, you know, your only option if they don't keep going with these is you know, like the showcases. The showcases I was looking, I think, go into like around 180 or so. The earliest issue I have of actual issues of Barry Allen Flash is like 230 something, I think. Because I started, once I like completed my run of the Wally West Flash, mm-hmm. I started to pick up Barry Allen Flash when I saw him.
My earliest issue is 117, which is the first appearance of Captain Boomerang.
Nice.
I have the first appearance of the Top. I bought a lot of these when they weren't extremely like expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I was smart back in my college days. I bought a lot of books that are worth a lot more than they, you know, than I got them for.
Yeah.
Back in the day. But I have a pretty solid run from issue 220 on.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the way to the end for the most part. There might be one or two issues I'm missing in there. But yeah, I'd like to fill these. I was just looking at the cover for 120, and it sure looks like those Lily Putneyans come back.
Nice. That's always fun when you think a character is like a throwaway character. You don't mm-hmm. expect something to come back, and then they do.
Well, I want to go look for that other guy, the guy that's made from iron, because he was interesting to me, and the fact that he was blasting people with the gun that makes them smarter is pretty hilarious.
I want to find the guy, the new genius, and see if he's made another appearance, or if not, I'm going to put together my proposal.
Your proposal. Yeah. So I think that wraps up this episode. What do we got on? What are we going to do next one? Are we going to go back to Jack or?
I mean, did you want to work towards finishing it? I mean, we've done 2 volumes of Fourth World, and we got 2 left.
Yeah, let's go ahead and do 3 issues out of that.
We can go back and finish
and then,
that up.
Why don't we pick one Steve Ditko book to cover? You pick one and I'll pick one.
Okay, just something.
Something random,
Yeah, I'll read something. Because I can probably, I don't know if I have anything trade-wise, but I know if not all of his stuff.
Oh, you could find something on that Marvel, I'm sure.
Exactly.
Marvel.
Yeah.
Site.
Yeah, I know that most of his stuff's on there.
Mm-hmm.
So, All right, I'm gonna go roll some more D6s. That's the lingo.
3 is not a good sign. He said that's not a good roll.
Uh oh.
So that what he didn't reply other than that's not good.
Uh oh.
But you know,
Dirty Sanchez or something.
Yeah. I think that's what it is, Dirty Sanchez. All right, so this has been Geek Brunch Retro Episode 13, Lucky 13.
13th Floor Elevators.
I'm Mike and my host, Chris. You can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com. And We have Twitter accounts at MythMakingETC and at Mike Myers Brunch. You can go like our Facebook page if you search for Geek Brunch Podcast and click on the like button. We're at Forum for Geeks. If you scroll down to Geek Brunch, we always have threads for the show topics. And I'm still growing my list of what I read a week. Mm-hmm.
That thread seems like it has a decent amount of views.
People are picking that up and rolling with it. In other words, There's other people that Paul is one of them, and there's another guy that's posting their reads. They both read a lot. They're cool. Both in my territory of 30 to 50 books a week.
Emails are Mike at Comic Book Noise and MythMakingETC@gmail.com. And that just reminds me, I want to say thanks to Steven for sending us our first email for the show. So that always goes a long way. It's encouraging to know people are enjoying the show.
Yeah, we also got a Twitter just recently that it's from Reed and or at Bonneville. He just says a big thanks to us for all the great podcasts. Much appreciated.
Oh, cool.
Just came across right now.
Oh, nice. And I think that covers the contact information.
Yeah. Sure, and join us. And then I'd like to, if you can email me or Facebook me or whatever, if you can find some Doom Patrol stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'll take a look. I think you're right that there are some showcases that might be the least expensive way of getting the early stuff at least.
Yeah. The showcase, I think it does exist. I think I actually have it. I just happen to have the color archive as well because I got it for 50% off.
Yeah, but
the archives have gotten outrageously expensive.
I know,
they're almost like $65 to $75 a copy.
Yeah, I mean, I do understand why that is. I just don't have the money to buy that few issues for the amount, you know.
That's the reason I haven't ordered the second one, because that volume is so high.
I prefer to read color comics if that's how they were published. You know, I don't go for the showcases unless I don't really have another option that's affordable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I don't mind, you know, I don't mind reading them that way, but...
You'd prefer them in color. Like we're reading The Flash.
Yeah, I love the
comics. I don't think we'd get the same experience if we read that in black and white.
No, and I mean, like, you know, you could get these in the archives. But you'd be, you know, like these are like, you can get these like the cover price 15, you can usually get them around like $10, you know, whereas if you got these issues in the archives, it'd be like four times the amount.
I wish more people would buy them so they'd encourage them to do it more. Do you know what I mean? Because these are really like what you get for the value you get it. Like, it's just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't. These books are not easily accessible.
No, like,
if you wanted to buy them, you're going to spend thousands of dollars. And if you want to buy the hardcovers, they're expensive. I mean, you know, $50 to $75.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can get it for $15 and read the stories and take the journey, it's really worth it.
Yeah, and I think that's why we're getting like your big, you know, they're doing the big Justice Leaguers and stuff like that, because they've done the archives already. They've recouped some of the costs of the restoration and stuff like that, so now they can make some, like, you know, make these and just basically make some extra profit off of the work that they already did to make the archives. So
I wish they would do the Legion ones like this, because I'd be very interested.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah. All right, well, you have a good weekend, and we'll talk to you in... oh man, well, we may talk to you in 2 weeks. I'll have to talk to you.
Yeah, look at the schedule of your cons and stuff, and you know
I'll have to see where everything falls.
Yeah.
All right. Well, have
Sounds good.
Talk to you later. Bye.